are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Thursday, July 11th, 2019. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live, not steps, or I should say not only steps, from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, but also in the birthplace of America, Philadelphia. Is it the birthplace?
Close enough.
Close to the birthplace of America, Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. In the Philadelphia, Pennsylvania Convention Center in downtown Philadelphia, it's Netroots Nation 2019, ladies and gentlemen. And I am here live today. I will be talking to an array of individuals and going over stories and going out for drinks, co-mingling with the Netroots, as it were. Exciting stuff here in Philadelphia. Not going over some of the top stories. We will get to those to a certain extent. Nothing massive, although Trump has claimed that he can order the citizenship question added to the census via executive order. It is unclear how he can do that. In light of the fact the Supreme Court said you can't. But we will remain to be seen what happens. This will undoubtedly create some type of constitutional crisis. And
Constitutional crises are good and easy to win.
They could very well be, frankly. I believe so. Part of what I would say is, you know, part of the problem what's happening in Congress is that they could very well be super easy to win for Donald Trump. Maybe too easy. And
Maybe.
We'll see. But watch out if he tries to have a constitutional crisis on the do not call registry list.
I will go to the mat. No one wants to hear about fake St. Kitts vacations after 8 p.m., Mr. President. I will fight you.
I was going to say, if you're going to have a constitutional crisis, make sure you do it not at dinner time, because people don't want to be bothered
people
at dinner time.
People don't want to be bothered.
For a constitutional crisis.
It was the All-Star Game just the other night, and you want to interrupt hardworking Americans in Massapequa? How dare you?
But we will obviously be tracking that citizenship question. Yesterday, I'm sure Michael touched on the fact that the Supreme Court said to the Justice Department lawyers on the census question, sorry, no, you cannot exit this case. You can't come in and lie to us and then say, we're going to go away.
Caught us in the lie. So what we're going to do is
imagine the other lawyers who go in, your colleagues lied to us. Yeah, no, we haven't seen them for like 2 weeks. They went on vacation, and I'm in a different department, so I don't see them. The EPA is changing transparency rules around the Freedom of Information Act. This, of course, is so that you cannot see how degraded our environmental protection has become. And 2 days ago, we mentioned this in the Fifth Circuit, and this feels like deja vu all over to me, frankly. The Fifth Circuit of Appeals in New Orleans, three-judge bank, two of the judges appointed by Republican presidents, one Trump, one Bush, George Walker Bush, I should say, GW, The case is been brought by, I think, about a 16, maybe 18 states, led by Republicans. And the case is that when the Republicans got rid of the mandate, what they did is they basically said there was going to be no penalties for the mandate. It's going to be a toothless mandate. And they did this through reconciliation. Recall that reconciliation allows for a simple majority. It prevents any type of like parliamentary procedures you could use to gum up the works. But it can only impact things that impact the budget in terms of dollars. So all they could do, because they could not get it together, they could not find, the, you know, Congress, essentially the way you would articulate it is Congress did not want to repeal the Affordable Care Act. They were only able to basically make the mandate toothless. These states went to court and said, well, now that you have a toothless mandate, it makes the law unconstitutional because there's no way to enforce the mandate. And as the mandate is not really a mandate anymore, the rest of the state, the law must be repealed because this was congressional intent was to end the law. Now, of course, Congress didn't end the law. Their intent was not to do that. And we know they didn't do it because they didn't do it. There may have been people in Congress who wanted to. There may be people in Congress today, Republicans, who want to repeal the law. But because they don't have the votes, they can't do it. That's the way you judge congressional intent. And below that, it would have to be, you know, what is the intent of an law? You know, if there's questions about a law they passed, then theoretically, you could look at some of the transcripts, but that's not as holding as to what they talk about in passing it. So no one took this case seriously because it's a joke. It's an absolute joke. But it appears in the court proceedings that at least two of these judges did take it seriously. And I just remember being out in front of the Supreme Court for a couple of days, interviewing all sorts of constitutional professors and lawyers and saying like, oh, there's no way, you know, talking about the Affordable Care Act that was in front of the Supreme Court. And I remember all of them to a person said, and there's one other provision about they're arguing that you can't force people to expand Medicaid if they're going to participate in the Medicaid program. And to be honest with you, that just seems like a joke. There's no way this court could possibly find that. And that's literally what they did. So there is no ridiculousness that is too great for these Republican-appointed judges. Let me do a couple of ad reads, and then I'm going to introduce our first guest that we have here, and then we'll get to some of the sound. I know that we got sound there. But as you know, folks, it can be hard to sit down and find the time to read. I know this. But there's an app that will change that for you. It's called Blinkist. Blinkist is the only app that takes the best key takeaways, the need-to-know information from thousands of nonfiction books, and condenses them down to just 15 minutes for you to read or listen to. These are the Monarch notes that we used to have as a kid, crib notes. Blinkist is made for busy people like you or me, frankly, who want to get to the main points quickly without reading the entire book. And with its audio feature, Blinkist makes it easy to finish a book during your commute, on your lunch break, while you exercise. In fact, 10 million people are using Blinkist right now. It has a massive and growing library from self-help to business to health and history books. Folks, I have told you time and time again, I have no time to read outside of the stuff I have to read for this program. And with Blinkist, I can get to those things that I, you know, like I've mentioned before, I'm a Tim Ferriss fan. I listen to the 4-Hour Workweek I listened to it in less than 4 hours. I listened to it in 15 minutes.
I win, Tim.
I've out Tim Ferriss, Tim Ferriss.
I out
but there's
Tim
a ton of books like that. There's, you know, The Power of Habits by that Charles Duhigg guy. 10 Reasons Why You're Wrong About the World and Why Things Are Better Than You Think by Von Hans Rosling. Fire and Fury is on here. Inside the Trump White House by Michael Wolff. I got to check that one out, actually. No, it just makes it easy. There's, you know, some of these things, frankly, you know, when you're talking about, with all due respect to Tim Ferriss, I don't need to read the sinew. I want just the, I want the bullet points. I want the takeaways. Right? That's not being mean. Matt, why are you laughing?
I'm not laughing.
I don't want the sinew, Tim. I want to know. I want the 4-hour work week in a 30-hour work day.
That does not make sense.
I know. I miss
right now, for a limited time, Blinkist has a special offer for just our audience. Go to Blinkist.com/majority. Start your 7-day free trial. That's Blinkist, spelled Blinkist.com/majority to start your free 7-day trial. Blinkist.com/majority. Also, when I'm on the road, folks, it used to be I'd have to carry my hand toothbrush, and I always felt like, oh, I'm not getting my teeth clean. You know, I'm living in an era right now where I am totally dentally hygienic sensitive. Packing a toiletries, you know how tight it can be. It always involves a delicate game of stacking and space hacking. That's why Quip electric toothbrushes work just as well at home as they do on the go. The compact and wireless design tucks easily into the corner of your carry-on. Plus, travel-ready cover acts as a stand, mounts to hotel mirrors, and protects your brush from sandy swimsuits and luggage slip-ups. Better yet, the 3-month battery life will last you through a season filled with weekends away, and brush heads are automatically delivered on a dentist-recommended schedule for just $5, so you'll always have fresh bristles. They're making it easier than ever to keep up with your wake-up and wind-down routine when you're out of the office. You know why I love Quip. I no longer have this massive monster on the corner of my very tiny sink. It's super easy to travel with it. I've told you before, my sister calls me now multiple times. Her dentist is thanking her for me giving her a Quip. That and more is why I love Quip and why I'm taking it right here to Philadelphia. I have my Quip with me. I left it at the hotel. Quip starts for just $25, and if you go to getquip.com/majority right now, you can get your first refill pack for free. That's your first refill pack for free at getquip.com/majority. Getquip.com/majority. All right. Joining me right now is the host of the Dean Obadala Show on the Sirius Satellite Network. Dean, welcome to the program.
Sam, great to see you. Once a year we see each other at Netroots, I think.
That's basically it. Although I think next year it'll be 2, because I'll probably see you at the DNC as well.
Perhaps if they allow me to go to DNC, it's up to SiriusXM, but hopefully they will. I think I will.
Why wouldn't they do that?
I don't know. It works with just budgetary. It's a big company. There's a lot of budget issues. But if I have my choice, yes, I'll be at the DNC. And I think I will be, in all likelihood.
Yeah, I think you should be. I mean, it would be ridiculous if you didn't. But that aside, why would budgets matter? I'm looking here at a news story. Let's see. Wait a second. Let me just go back in here. Because I'd read something the other day, Dean.
Yes.
You've been on radio now for, I don't know, what, 5 years?
No. Well, SiriusXM, I've been full-time for 2 years and a month doing 3 hours a night. Before that, I was doing 1 hour a day.
Okay. And you're also a Daily Beast contributor, is
yeah.
that right?
Yeah.
So I noticed this about a month ago, and everybody in the office started making plans. Daily Beast contributor wins $4.1 million from a neo-Nazi.
That's right. That's what you're going
to... Now, that's the best way to make money, as far as I'm concerned. And let me just ask you right now, let's just get this, let's just clear the air.
Sure.
Can I have a loan?
Let me talk to my butler slash valet and see if he has some money he can lend me. He drives around in our Rolls Royce now that's made of Nazi money. That it's really funny. They sent me obviously, as Sam knows here, winning a judgment against an individual and collecting a judgment of $4.1 million is a lot more challenging.
Two different things.
And vastly different things. And that's the world, as a lawyer, that's what happens. But the whole idea of the lawsuit was to send a message to these neo-Nazis that they can't just smear
people
and destroy them.
All right, tell the story. Tell the story.
What happens in May of 2017, 3 months before Charlottesville, I wrote an article for the Daily Beast saying, why won't Trump say the words white supremacist terrorism? And what happened was there were already three or four incidences in the first 4 or 5 months of his presidency where white, self-professed white supremacists had killed Americans. And my whole point was, Trump, you demanded we say radical Islamic terrorism.
Right.
That's all you kept saying. If you don't say it, you can't solve it. That whole BS, right? So my simply used his argument, why won't you say the words white supremacist terrorism? I didn't attack the Daily Stormer or Andrew Englund, who runs the Daily Stormer, in that article. I talked about Trump and white supremacy and the emboldenment of it under Trump before Charlottesville, going, there's something percolating here, and Trump, you got to do something about it. Well, the people at the Daily Stormer were so incensed, and Andrew Englund specifically, who runs the Daily Stormer. If you don't know the Daily Stormer, you're lucky, but it's named after Der Stürmer, which is one of Hitler's favorite tabloids.
Right.
It was a way of reaching out to the masses. It's been around for years, the Daily Stormer. It is the go-to number one website, at least at the time, of neo-Nazis, white supremacists. They go there, they exchange ideas.
Groupons,
whatever they do. You know, great deals on artwork, whatever they're all into. You know, that's what they're all about. So they were so outraged that I wrote this article attacking Donald Trump, and that's their beloved. They fabricated tweets saying I was involved in a bombing in Manchester, England at the Ariana Grande concert.
What do you mean they
fabricated tweets that look like real tweets. They were my tweets. They wiped out the words. They even added more retweets and likes than I usually get, which is kind of nice. It's kind of weird. They did that. And they put things like, I'm the mastermind of the bombing of the Ariana Grande concert, and 22 are dead, and I did this for Allah, and thank Allah that you're dead, and I'm now with my ummah, or the Muslims in the Brotherhood in Syria, and this kind of stuff. So they wrote all this stuff. So first I see it, I'm like, is this on my Twitter feed? But it was just in an article they had written. And so I went and looked at the article, made it look like I had really tweeted this stuff. And they wrote an article seriously about these tweets saying, Dean is a terrorist, self-professed terrorist. He killed these people. Go confront him. But they also talked about my article saying, and look what a traitor he is and all this stuff. He's attacking white people because I think they thought I was white. I'm not really sure. But they knew I was Muslim, so they were kind of confused by the whole thing. So that's what led to death threats against me, and that led to the lawsuit. Me hiring lawyers who did it pro bono, but big law firm Latham & Watkins and a law firm in Chicago, in Ohio, where Andrew Englund is based, the Chandra Law Firm. And we sued them over a year and a half and got this judgment.
Wow, that's pretty cool.
You know, it's 2019. I'm fighting Nazis, all right, Sam? This is where we are in America.
So what happens with that? Like, does this guy... You have to send you 10% of his income?
I have Nazi money coming out of the yin-yang right now.
Are you now like...
I'm in business with...
Are you now basically over at the Daily Stormer going like, we've got to pick this up in terms of getting advertising for this stuff.
He has to do live reads for my show. on Andrew Englund.
That would be amazing.
On Nazi podcast. First of all, this is brought to you by that Muslim that we despise at SiriusXM. Listen to his show and curse him out every day.
Get 10% off.
Right, 10% off.
SiriusXM.
Use Muslim scum. 10% off right now. So, no, we had an expert who testified we had a proof hearing. He didn't show up. His father, we subpoenaed his father. So we deposed his father, but his father was involved giving the money and all this stuff, so tracing the assets. And we had an expert testify about Andrew Englund's Bitcoin accounts. These experts can actually find when you have Bitcoin accounts and what's in it and stuff like that.
Oh, geez,
so like a bank account. So we're trying to see if we can seize that. And whatever money I get, I'm not keeping the Nazi money. I'm going to give it to groups that fight Nazis, like SPLC and the ADL and Muslim Advocates who represented me in this case. And, you know, groups that they hate. You know, all the people they hate, I'm going to give the money to
not
fight
all
their bigotry.
You got
to
keep some.
We're going to get a few. If I got $4 million, maybe I would have kept a little. We're going to get, I hope we get a few thousand dollars so they feel it personally.
Right.
And also maybe deters contributors going, this Dino Bidal, this Muslim guy's taking all the money we give to him. Let's not give him any money. So we're trying to strangle his money supply because he's out
right,
there.
Right. So you can garnish anything that's
donated.
We got
a personal judgment and a corporate judgment.
Wow.
So he can file for bankruptcy, of course, and get a discharge, but that's up to him.
Good for you.
He's a scumbag.
And was it scary while you were going through this? I mean, was there ever a time where you're like, oh, I'm a little nervous about this?
In the beginning, I was, because the Daily Stormer is not a run-of-the-mill website. It's not armchair neo-Nazis. Dylan Roof was a reader.
Right.
A guy who came to New York named James Jackson, who killed a black man to start a race war in March 2017, who I wrote about in that article, was a reader. There's a guy who killed a member of parliament in England, you might recall, right before the Brexit vote, was a reader. So these are really extreme, I'm not going to say mentally ill people, because Dylan Roof was not mentally incompetent. They are sane white supremacists who are dangerous. So I was concerned. I mean, I immediately had to contact SiriusXM security and the Daily Beast security over there, because finding me is harder, but finding where I might go into work is much easier. And I really was worried that some crazy person, I shouldn't say crazy, they're not, they're sane white supremacists, they're Nazis, and would come to my workplace. So I had alert security there. I would get death threats and hate mail, and you start worrying about, I get a few letters that were no return address, and you don't open them.
Right.
And you start getting worried about that kind of stuff. So it changes your daily life on a certain level.
Interesting. Well, that is quite the drama.
That's the story of the day.
Story of the day. I imagine you've been telling that story quite a bit.
I did tell it a lot, and I'm happy to share it because I'm hoping that it inspires people to keep standing up to these neo-Nazis, because I could have just forgotten about it or don't mention it and hope they don't come after me or something. But I would rather you stand up. My whole point is stand up. We go to court. We use the court system. We sue them. We get a judgment, and we take their money. That's the most American thing to do, you can do, I think. I'm celebrating America at its finest. I'm getting lawyers, suing you, and taking your money. So I'm hoping we can deter fundraising for the Daily Stormer for the future.
Oh, well, good for you. All right. Well, let's talk a little bit about Netroots Nation.
Sure.
You've been coming to this for quite a while.
Actually, last year was my first year.
Oh, that's
right. This is only my second year. I came because SiriusXM sent us here. I was very happy to come here to cover this and meet a lot of progressive activists, some who are too hesitant to talk. I'm trying to do man on the street thing. I talked to like five people. Only one would talk to me on radio. I'm like, you're an activist. You're here. Don't you want to talk about the issues of concern to you? So it's kind of weird. But there's a lot of energy here.
Yeah, there is. It seems like a lot. Even more maybe than there was last year.
They said they expect more this year. That's what I heard.
3,500 people. And, of course, we've got half a dozen candidates that are going to be here, I think. Elizabeth Warren is going to be here. Kristen Gillibrand, Julian Castro, Jay Inslee. Sherrod Brown's going to be here. Jeff Merkley, Barbara Lee, Pramila Jayapal will be here. Ayanna Pressley, Ilhan Omar, Rashida Tlaib, Deb Haaland, Eleanor Holmes Norton, Alex Padilla. Then there's some Secretary of States and Keith Ellison.
It's a good group.
Here.
I like the I mean, to me, I'm really more interested in talking to the activists, the elected officials. You know, you interview them, I interview them. That's sort of normal. They call in. But I want to talk to the grassroots people and see about, there is often a disconnect between this grassroots and I don't want to say elite in a dismissive, pejorative way, but the elite in our party. And I think on impeachment, you're seeing it completely.
Oh my God.
So clearly, where Nancy Pelosi is building up more ire, when people call my show and they're angry at her as much as they're angry at any Republican at this point.
Yeah.
And it's remarkable what's going on.
Yeah, it's stunning. What's your sense? I mean, I think that's, you know, I sort of feel like that's going to be the theme of most of my conversations today, because there really does seem to be not just a reluctance to impeach, which I can understand the rationale for that argument. It's not an irrational argument. I think it's a bad one at this point, and it gets worse every day. But there also seems to be just like a complete allergy to finding anything out that's wrong with the Trump administration. Like, why don't you go for his taxes? Why aren't you denouncing Acosta? I mean, what's it going to take?
Like, well, the problem is, and Trump stonewalls.
What are you
going to
make them own?
When they're doing judicial oversight, they'll serve a subpoena after first cordially trying to invite them over, which I guess I get why they do that, but legally, to lay the groundwork for a lawsuit. But now Trump says no to everything. Everything. You can't even talk to. They just had a testimony earlier this week that they had over 200 objections to the assistant of Don McGahn. You're getting nothing. At least in an impeachment hearing, if they did that, that would be on national TV. And all of America would see the Trump lawyers objecting 200 times. People go,
What do you make of Nancy Pelosi not wanting to do any of this?
This is ridiculous to me. Do the impeachment inquiry. It's simply that the Judiciary Committee formally votes, and you have the hearings, and you have them over 6 or 8 months. America would focus on that. They'd be calling an impeachment inquiry. At the end, you know, Chairman Nadler and others can say, here's our findings, we have to do articles of impeachment, or here's our findings. And you know what? It doesn't rise to that. But not doing an impeachment inquiry, to me, is unforgivable. And she's essentially putting her speakership on the line for this, because if he were to win in 2020... and we don't do an impeachment inquiry, yes. She's got to go.
She's got to go.
She's probably got to go anyway, at this point.
Yes. I mean, come on. This is ridiculous. What else? Anything else you've been covering?
I'll talk about a healthcare thing. I just wrote about it for The Beast, and we covered it yesterday, that you have Trump lying at his June kickoff in Orlando last month, saying, I'm going to protect pre-existing conditions. Meanwhile, since March, his administration has been in that federal appeals court arguing, and they wrote a brief in May, which I went through, arguing to strike down the entire ACA and every part of it, including coverage of pre-existing conditions. No joke, everything. ACA, pre-existing conditions, no more coverage, gone.
We just, I just mentioned that was the case of the Fifth Circuit, it appears they're going to rule in a way that everyone thought would be insane
for them
to rule.
And then you go to Supreme Court and you hope for the best up there. There's Chief Justice Roberts. And, you know, there's two of the three appointees in that Court of Appeals who were GOP appointees. And the reporting is they were very, very questioning and not at all on board with the idea of taking away this mandate and not jeopardizing the rest of the law, because that was the linchpin.
The question
is
severability, right? I mean, that's really what it centers around, the ability to sever the mandate from the rest. And they're arguing that it's not, was not intended to be severed, even though Congress specifically had a crack at taking out the whole law. They didn't want to.
Right.
And the only thing that they wanted to do in terms of voting for it was the get rid of the penalty for the mandate.
And to remind people again, this was all a Trump GOP contrived crisis, because in December 2017, when they voted for that tax cut, this was embedded in that. And there were articles, people could look back at the time, and I covered it on my show, people were warning them, if you get rid of the mandate, you're going to destabilize the ACA, and it might destroy the whole scheme. They didn't care. It was about tax cut for the donor base, so they didn't care. They took that away. So they created this crisis, and now GOP-appointed judges are... The 1-2 punch is 20 AGs and a governor who are Republican fighting to bring it down, and now the judges are the third punch and look like they're going to do the job of getting rid of the ACA for us.
Completely nuts. All right. Well, Dean Abadala, I know you got to go get your show together.
Good talking to you. It was always nice seeing you. I'll interview on my show, and you'll be on hopefully later on today.
All right, beautiful.
Thanks, Dan.
All right, thanks. All right, folks. We're going to take a quick break and play an interview that I did with David Dayen just moments ago. We'll have other guests as we sort of look around. It's the beginning of the conference. So in part, we're just throwing out a net and seeing who we can catch coming by us as we're sitting here in one part of the conference. Let's, Matt, are you good to, okay, why don't you run that now? Continuing our coverage here at Netroots Nation 2019 in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. Joining me is someone who I spoke to, I think, at the very first, wasn't called Netroots Nation at the time, it was called Yearly Co's. And that was in Las Vegas. That was up in a Sky booth.
Yes.
The Majority Report was the there was the only radio row. Yes. There was no other radio there, as far as I know.
You were saying, you are looking live.
Were looking, and of course, it was at it's in the evening, and it was, well, that was back in the day. David Dayen, welcome back to the program.
Thank you.
A pleasure. There's a lot of stuff going on here. I want to get into the Meta Netroots thing in a bit. But there's two things I want to talk to you about. And one, that is an article that is in the American Prospect, of which you are the executive editor now.
That's right, prospect.org.
And the other is something that's going to be taking place, and I should just say, we're pre-taping this at almost 11 o'clock in the morning, because at noon there is a protest. And this is something that Netroots has adopted in the past, I think, like half a dozen years.
Yeah.
They get involved in the communities that they're in. There is an issue around the corner from here.
Yeah.
Involving a hospital. You were telling me a little bit of it last night when I was doing my pre-research.
He's a tireless worker, ladies and gentlemen.
At a bar.
He's always, always, always hustling for you.
It's the conversations at the bars, I should say, you know, surrounding Netroots is probably some of like the highest level nerd.
The
like,
nerdiest just, conversations you'll ever hear at a bar. Yes.
Great way to scare away other people. But.
Yes.
Okay. So there's a hospital.
Mm-hmm.
This involves a hedge funder, and it's almost I want to say it's a metaphor, but it's actually not even, it's just illustrative of what's happening all across the country.
So we have a piece, it's our feature story today at prospect.org, by Mike Elk, who's a labor reporter, about this hospital. It's called Hahnemann University Hospital. It's just steps from here in Philadelphia, and it's 171 years old. And 2 years ago, it was bought by a private equity firm, a guy named Joel Friedman, and it's Paladin Healthcare is the sort of holding company that he used to purchase this thing 2 years ago. This is a hospital that serves a very low-income community. Over half of the patients are on Medicaid. Another chunk are on Medicare. Two-thirds of the patients are Black or Latino. It serves a very low-income community, and there is no reason for a private equity firm that's for-profit to buy a hospital that serves such a low-income community. There are lower reimbursement rates. It's not a money-making enterprise to be a low-income-serving hospital. Usually, if a private equity firm or a for-profit firm is going to buy a hospital, they're going to partner it with suburban hospitals,
right.
Ones that can, outpatient clinics, something that can earn them a lot of money to keep, cross-subsidize the low-income hospital, keep it going. Paladin's entire portfolio is urban, low-income-serving hospitals. They have Howard University Hospital in Washington, D.C. They have four low-income hospitals in Los Angeles, and they have Hahnemann in Philadelphia.
And all these low-income hospitals, and here's the clue, right,
are
these urban centers.
In big cities,
that are
improving the areas surrounding the hospital. So, newsflash, here's what comes next. So 2 years after buying this hospital, Paladin put Hahnemann into bankruptcy, but only the hospital, not the underlying real estate, which is this very lucrative real estate in what is called a gateway community for gentrification. And he is selling the real estate to the highest bidder. It is very likely that what will be built there are luxury condos or really lucrative housing and real estate to develop that and get rid of this hospital, which has been there for almost 200 years.
Something like this happened to St. Vincent's in New York City,
right,
half a dozen years ago. But wait a second. So let me just walk me through how this works out. He buys the hospital. It comes with the property, obviously. And
he puts no money into the hospital. He does not invest in any resources for the hospital.
He sets up another entity, an LLC or an S-Corp,
right,
or whatever it is. He sells the property from the first entity, which is the hospital.
He's in the process of doing this. But yes, you basically split the company from the real estate. And we see this all the time in private equity.
And then the hospital pays a lease.
Pays rent. Yeah.
Rent.
It's called a sale leaseback. And we saw it with the Marsh grocery chain. We saw it with Sears. Sears did a sale leaseback deal where they put the real estate into a separate entity and then had the company.
We spoke about that. And the CEO basically had a side business,
right,
which is like, oh, I'm going to be the real estate owner for the Sears company.
Right.
And I'm going to bilk the hell out of the company.
That's
because,
right,
I don't have as much interest in the company as I do in the real estate.
And the Sears properties that he split off were in very lucrative areas, like the one in California, in Los Angeles, is in downtown Santa Monica, an incredibly lucrative piece of real estate, and they actually closed the facility, and it's you know, Edward Lampert's decision to close a Sears, right? So he closes the facility, the real estate then goes into the hands of this Seritage, this extra company, and then they can develop it. And so they're developing that property in Santa Monica. But this is a similar play. But it's kind of the first time, I know St. Vincent's is similar, but this is the first time that a private equity firm, the first time that our experts could figure out that a private equity firm has sold off the real estate of a hospital. And if it works, this is going to be a model, not just for this guy's stuff in D.C. and L.A., but other firms will get the message that, oh, I can buy an urban hospital in a gentrifying area and then sell it off after a few years for the real estate and make billions of dollars. This is a really important story because of what this signifies as a private equity model to put profit over the health of millions of Americans.
And then I guess presumably they're going to be looking for any other type of like major institutional buildings that are located.
Educational facility or, you know, who knows.
Schools. Yeah. And so that creates pressure to sort of probably close some inner.
And by the way, the 2017 tax law that Trump passed is actually, the deductibility of interest, which is why private equity uses this debt load model where they put debt onto a company because that interest on the debt is deductible from taxes. It's a tax advantage. So they, in the tax bill, they limited the deductibility of interest, which cuts against private equity's model. However, there's an exception for real estate in that. And big surprise, Trump puts an exception for real estate in this model of deducting interest. So there is an incentive for private equity firms to do these real estate plays now in the tax code, embedded in the tax code. And so there's even more reason, not just that it's lucrative, but it's also a great tax break for them.
All right, and folks can read more about this. You can read more about this in the Prospect.
As we speak.
Okay.
There is a rally going on there with members of Netroots Nation and the union of nurses that is fighting this. Bernie Sanders' campaign has latched onto this as an example of putting greed and profits over health care. I believe Nina Turner will be there at this rally, and I've heard rumblings that Bernie might show up as well. There's sort of an action that's going on today around this. I'm going to go down there and cover it.
Yeah, I think we may actually send Brendan down, too, with a video camera. Maybe he can get a little bit of what's going on there. But the idea, I mean, you know, sort of turning towards Netroots, mm-hmm. The idea for these type of things is to draw attention to it. When we were in Detroit, which was 6-7 years ago, maybe?
Maybe 5 years ago. It was about the water shutoffs,
It was
right?
about the yeah. water. And that helped, I think, bring a lot of attention
and
to
I
that issue.
And I remember in Arizona, they did a tour of one of Joe Arpaio's camps, I believe.
And so this, you know, having a mass of activists just show up at an event in a city, you know, any size city, but you know, particularly one that's not like a New York or an LA or a Chicago, that makes news, and then things start to loosen up a little
this
bit.
This has already been an extremely controversial issue in Philadelphia.
I bet.
But there's you know, some sense that it's they're fighting a losing battle, but you know, bringing national attention to this, I think, can help in possibly at least delaying or forestalling this. There are other hospitals in the area. There's almost kind of a cluster of hospitals around here, but they're all oversubscribed. They already are full to the gills.
Right.
And you got hundreds of patients, thousands of patient visits over the course of a year that now have nowhere really to go. And this is a very low-income community that is served by this hospital.
And I should say the other, you know, part of that story is that this is another example of Sanders' campaign going in. I don't know how it works, frankly, how well it works and what implications it's going to have for his candidacy. But I mean, I don't think that we've seen a candidacy that seems so focused on leveraging the value they get as a candidate and the attention they get.
Yeah.
In leveraging that for things like Walmart workers, for something like this. I have a feeling there's been a half a dozen other things. They've been using their email list. It's a great model.
It's really interesting, and it speaks to their whole not me, us kind of frame this year. And they have sent out warnings to communities around ICE raids.
Using
their email list. I was told last night that the Sanders campaign has sent over 50 million texts already. The entire 2016 campaign, they sent around 80 million.
Wow.
And we're a year out from the end of the campaign. They are using it as an organizing opportunity, maybe even to their detriment campaigns are supposed to be focused on getting a guy elected, but they are building a different model.
Right.
I think they're defining success differently. They're defining success as, can we get improvements for these communities while we have this spotlight on us through the presidential campaign?
The analog to me is sort of the social justice unionism, mm-hmm. where, we saw in the context of the Chicago strikes, and this happens a lot with teachers' unions, where because they already have such an intimate relationship with a bigger part of the community, their students and the parents, they get more involved in a wider range of issues.
Right.
I mean, frankly, it would be great if all of the campaigns were engaging in this type of stuff, using the media attention they get.
Right.
And usually,
to the extent that they do, a normal campaign would put out a press release saying, I support, these workers, or even show up at a picket line. I mean, we saw Biden do that. We saw Warren do that at the Stop and Shop up in New England.
Yeah.
But this takes it a step further. I mean, this is real organizing that's going on and leveraging your most dedicated volunteers and supporters to come out and get engaged in issues and policies.
Well, when I had Bernie on the show a couple of weeks ago, I had asked, specifically thinking about Obama for America, which was an organization that was organizing and mobilizing, wasn't doing necessarily this type of work, but everybody presumed it would.
Right.
And
it didn't.
And he just shut it down.
Yeah.
And I asked Bernie specifically, is this campaign contingent?
Right.
And it was an emphatic no.
Right.
But this is an interesting sort of twist, and it's going to be interesting to see mm-hmm. how that, what the implications are of that.
Absolutely.
What I'd also like to see, and I'll probably have this conversation with other people because I want to get to some other things with you, is these candidates use that their attention to implicate what's going on in Congress, because there's some real problems, I think, that we're having right now with Pelosi and Schumer. But that may be for another time.
Yeah.
Because I want to talk to you also about this story about Amazon that you've got running mm-hmm. in The Prospect. Tell us about that.
Sure. So I wrote a story yesterday at The Prospect about Amazon and specifically about this issue of forced arbitration, which I'm sure you've talked about on the show. These are the clauses in consumer or employment contracts that essentially block the courthouse door. They force people who have disputes into a private, secret arbitration process where the company who uses this process all the time and might have the same arbiters
right, it has the same conflict that they did with the rating agencies with
right, the issuer
with
pays model.
They work more for the companies than they work for
exactly.
you as an individual.
And also you as an individual, if you have a dispute as a customer, for $50 over getting ripped off on something, are you going to pay a lawyer to go right. to this private process? You can't do class actions. And so I talked about it in the context of something that doesn't get talked about a lot, which is Amazon's marketplace. This is the third-party sellers that are on Amazon. There are over 2.5 million people on Amazon selling their goods. And sometimes it's their own brands that they've come up with. Sometimes they buy a bunch of stuff at a discount store and then resell it on Amazon. And all of them must sign this arbitration clause as part of their agreement of selling on Amazon. And in an employment context, this is the largest class, the largest entity of people who have signed an arbitration agreement, signed away their right to sue Amazon for over any dispute. And this creates this weird Byzantine private government, basically, that Amazon uses to govern its marketplace. And I talk about this in detail in the piece, but just as a short version, basically, Amazon has terms and conditions that change all the time. You have to abide by them. They can suspend you at any time for any reason. You get an email in the middle of the night and you say your account's suspended. It could be as much as one bad review that you get from a customer. It's a very customer is always right kind of place.
Right.
And if you are suspended, you obviously can't sue. You can go to arbitration, but that's a long shot. There's this weird appeals process that Amazon has outsourced all the appeals deciders to low-wage countries like India or Costa Rica or wherever. And the people who read these appeals have to read 17 of them an hour. So they're basically spending 3 minutes on your appeal, which is your livelihood. Because when you're suspended, you can't sell anything.
Right.
Any money that hasn't been remitted to you from prior sales, Amazon keeps. Amazon keeps your inventory. Amazon can sell your inventory if it's commingled with other inventory. If it's like a widget that's the same as other people's widget, they can just sell your stuff. You have to pay to get your inventory back. No, it's crazy.
Wow.
It's absolutely crazy. And the Amazon marketplace is a complete Wild West where people write fake reviews. They have counterfeits all over the place. There are all these ways that rivals try to scheme, do dirty tricks to get you off of the marketplace. And Amazon is in charge of all of that. And you can't, you know, the arbitration clause prevents you from seeking Article I courts to resolve any of these disputes.
Years ago, we had an Amazon link. At one point, they were starting to shut down links like ours, the way that we were using it, apparently.
Okay.
We got ours shut down. I had a check from them for, I don't know, it was $1,500.
Right.
And went to cash it. Bounced.
Wow.
They had shut it down. They'd issued
right.
the check. This is indicative, it seems to me, of all of these major tech companies where they don't want to have to hire human beings.
Right.
So they're going to do it as much as they can with algorithms.
They also don't want liability. So, like, they don't want to proactively do anything. If you give a complaint to them, they'll clean it up. But they don't want to have to say, well, we intervened here. Why didn't you intervene here?
Right.
And then your liability is increased. And, of course, the arbitration clause just amps that up another level, because then they're insulated from any kind of court lawsuits, and they go through this private secret process where the law isn't really applied uniformly. It's a case-by-case basis.
Right.
And I got to go in a couple minutes, but yeah. Just to put a point on this, like, we talk about this arbitration thing, and there's some working through companies like Google just ended its arbitration clause for sexual harassment cases. Other workers are organizing around these arbitration clauses. But this is a different animal. These are 2.5 million people who are essentially in competition with one another, selling on Amazon's marketplace, and their rights are being completely stripped by this arbitration clause. And they live in fear, essentially, that Amazon's, by
no
any
recourse.
Whim,
right.
can shut them down
no
with
recourse.
No recourse. And so this, I think, is a good way to talk about arbitration and what it can really do to people.
I will bring that up when we get to Vegas and we talk to some of these tort lawyers, because they have a real problem with this type of
Absolutely.
Provision. All right, I know you only get 2 minutes left.
Yes.
Netroots Nation, give me your 2 minutes summary of how it's evolved.
Well, it's early on. It's right. Early going here. But what I've been told is that this is the largest Netroots Nation ever.
Oh.
3,500 people will be at this weekend's event. It's brought some of us who've been here a while and then sort of drifted away. And this is my first year back after 2 years
away. I
feel
like I've had that conversation with a dozen people.
Yeah.
Why do you think that is?
Well, it's an election year, and I think, you know, having the presidentials, although there are only going to be four candidates here,
right.
My understanding. So having them here, I think, is part of it. And part of it is that it's easier to get here on the Acela.
Right.
Is part of it. But I don't know. I for me, this is my hometown. I wanted to come back for that reason, partially. But also reconnecting with this community, which is, you know, bigger, it's more diverse, it's got a bigger issue sort of space.
Right.
And I think it is, it does remain.
Let me bounce,
you know,
this theory.
It holds its credibility as an important conference.
Even though there are sort of, I think, more distinct flavors of the left, the roots of this was built in opposition to George Bush.
Yes.
And I think after a year or two now, because I felt like this was happening last year, was the first time I was back in 5 or 6 years,
mm-hmm.
that the being in the opposition party,
right,
being on the out, there's something that happens and, you know, things, there's a thrust that everybody can sign on to,
yeah,
even if you have disparate agendas within
that. Well, and it's true that, you know, people talk about, like, the one good thing about Trump is he's activated this, you know, people on the left, people just on the broad left,
right,
you know, left of center, to, you know, think about themselves as activists and engage in these issues in a broader way. And, you know, Netroots is certainly a part of that, always has been a part of that. And now you're seeing, you know, people from the center, people from, you know, the institutional machinery get really, you know, militant,
yeah,
about these issues. And so I think Trump has brought that to the fore. He did it in 2018. We'll see what happens in 2020. I think a lot of that is being defined right now by what is happening in Congress. And maybe we can talk about that another time.
Definitely.
And sort of demobilizing the left in some ways. But, you know, it's still strong, at least in a residual way right here. And we'll see how that goes.
David Dayan, prospect.org. Folks, go and get a subscription now.
Please. Please do. Thank you.
All right. Thanks, Dave.
All right. Take care.
I have no doubt that our next guest, who is on, my God, Sean McKelvey will be joining us in a bit. Very excited to, but in the meantime, Jesus, it's a lot of people don't know the ins and outs of radio.
Red on the air sign, or maybe like an electrical fence or something.
That's right. Dave Weigel's here with some production tips. He is the political correspondent for Washington Post. Is that?
Yeah, there are a bunch of us. I'm the one who writes the campaign newsletter, the trailer.
The trailer.
Yeah.
Yes, I read that quite a bit, actually.
Thank you.
Folks,
CIA Weigel.
Just sign up. And, of course, he also, back in the studio, wanted me. They're whispering about the CIA.
Yeah.
We never say it out loud.
Oh, no. Well, that's... I'm more into the NSA now. That's I'm more into using that to enact my global denomination agenda.
Yeah, there
tell
you
or
go.
That of my master's.
Tell
you know,
him that I say he's a fucking sellout.
Michael Brooks says you're a sellout. He's upset that you've left the CIA for the NSA.
That's right.
You're here in town, and I want to talk about. I want to get super meta.
Yeah.
With this, obviously, you're covering the campaign. We will undoubtedly get tips from you, or I should say, dispatches from you in the coming weeks and months. But again, people should sign up for the trailer. They can do that over the Washington Post site, right?
They can. Or if you follow me on Twitter, the pinned tweet gives you the link to follow up. Yeah.
And but you've been coming to these off and on for a decade?
Yeah,
more.
I didn't go to the 2006 one. I wish I had, which is the first. I've been coming since 2007. think I skipped three or four of them, but I've been to most of them. So if there's 14, I think I've been to 8 of them.
Yeah, I think that's more or less where I've been at, too. Yeah. Although I was there in 2006 with the first radio thing. I don't need to hype that too much.
The panels were really big that year, I saw. I remember there was like a plane. I don't remember because I wasn't there. I saw a video of the plane scandal panel was like 12 people.
Yes.
Including Joe Wilson.
There was, yes. Well, that was also a very interesting era in terms of the peak power in some ways, it seems to me, of the Netroots, right? Like Marcos, who at that time, I think it was Yearly Coast, was getting invited to Washington to talk to Democrats.
Yeah.
It's hard to imagine that now.
No.
But there's also not a Netroots.
But part of it is victory, right? I mean, Harry Reid's office became sort of the Daily Coast Senate office because he had Fast Shakir, he had a team that was trained up on the Netroots, and didn't deliver everything people wanted. But basically, so much of the early Netroots was we got to get Bush out of office. That eventually happened,
right?
I think for people, so. So, Victor, it's a constant question of, is it worth keeping this institution around forever if the purpose isn't there? And Netroots now is Daily Coast is still going strong.
Right.
There's some anonymous group blogs, but basically, there's probably more words written by Netroots attendees than ever, because everyone here is an activist, and they're all on Twitter, and they're on
Everyone
Facebook.
Seems to have set up, I mean, there's a lot more organizations here. Yeah. That trend has been happening for 4 or 5 years. Interesting, this year I get the sense that because there is, despite the fact there's sort of like a wide range of the politics from the center to the left here, having a president in opposition sort of changes the tenor of what's going on here a little bit.
I think it does. It's easy to imagine what it would have been like had Hillary Clinton become president. There was a lot of organizing that went on under Obama. I think that was going to continue, but probably in a different direction, probably with less intensity. Frankly, you would have had, I think, a similar amount of left-wing organizing, but not as much liberal, like resistance mom organizing. There wouldn't have been a resistance, I guess. You wouldn't have had as many people coming on off the sidelines. And some people I've met here actually... I was looking as if they're going to be right next to me, which is good radio. So people I met here, really, it's their first time. They're involved in Indivisible, or they were involved in swinging like a local state rep race, and they heard about this. So it's been refueled by a different kind of movement. But I think the movement's actually less left-wing than it would have been had Trump lost the election, because there's so many more... I guess the internet term that's just in my head is normies that have come into the movement, yeah.
Right. Well, but the odd thing is that my sense during those years when Obama was here is that to the extent that things were co-opted a little bit, there was also people weren't as comfortable with people agitating against Obama.
Yeah.
That's the weird thing about the politics here. Like, it would be very a lot of institutional support here. I wouldn't call, now, like, you were at the Socialist Conference.
Less institutional than this.
But there is crossover, because you get someone like AOC.
Yeah.
Who, she was here last year, I believe. She's not here this year. But the fighting partisan quality that seems to be associated with the more democratic socialists, which back in the Netroots day was just simply like fight.
Yeah.
Like be like, I think there seems to be near unanimity here that Nancy Pelosi is dropping the ball in some fashion.
You've had more conversations so far here than I have. I've heard, I guess when people are in doubt, they just focus on 2020, but there was a sense that you need to do is just stop the Trump agenda. I think people who wanted his legislative agenda to be stopped are pretty happy, but you can be happy about something, then you realize the other problem you have. I noticed, and I've seen this in the left for years, because impeaching Trump would mean Pence as president carrying on the agenda without the baggage, I didn't think that was much impeachment momentum, but it's more not picking every fight you can. not making everything a slog for Trump. I think it's more that than why are they getting him out of office. I think it's how come they're allowed to roll, how come they do this thing and we hear about it for 2 days and we don't hear about it again, because, and I'm using now is like the crowd of networks is, we had to watch Republicans make Benghazi a thing for 3 years. How come you guys are dropping everything?
Exactly.
Yeah.
Or just like in letting and not engaging, like the idea that you have no comment on Alex Acosta. Seriously?
Yeah.
Like what? You don't want the taxes? Mm-hmm. You can get them from New York.
Yeah.
Richard Neal doesn't want to take the taxes?
The New York thing, I think, is in progress, right? The New York tax case is actually kind of moving.
I'm not talking about the case.
But they're moving slower.
I know, but Cuomo signed a bill that said that Richard Neal could have Donald Trump's New York state taxes.
Yeah.
And Neal said, I don't want them.
Yeah.
Why?
Yeah, no, I haven't had as many conversations here. I think once I mill around more, that's going to be the anger. It's because Pelosi says she wants Trump to lose, and everyone here wants Trump to lose, and there's confusion about what her path is, because it seems to be, as somebody who's her life is making sure that 30 guys in Trump districts are reelected. Her life is based around those guys. Those districts are actually more conservative than what you need to do to win the presidency, and also, she doesn't seem to be shifting the terms of debate in a way that the new members of the House have been. I mean, I think every of the squad that we talk about, of Ayanna Pressley, Rashida Tlaib, Ilhan Omar, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, who all of them are pretty different. I mean, AOC's the only one who's never served an elected office before now. Three of them are here, and the fights they have picked up, the ideas they have gotten people to discuss, I think have been more exciting than what Pelosi's done. When Pelosi's done something that's pleased the left, it's something that the left demanded 5 years ago that they thought was too crazy, right? Like $15 minimum wage vote, things like that.
Well, you know, you look at someone like Katie Porter, who on paper should be one of those Democrats that Nancy Pelosi's worried about, right?
Yeah.
I mean, you would know this better than I would, but she seems to me to be in a more or less like purple district.
Yes.
And that a businessman could come running who was like maybe somewhat arm's length from Donald Trump, but on board with probably the entire agenda, not how rude Donald Trump is, and she should be in trouble. Yet, she's outraged just about every other... Why is she so unique in Nancy Pelosi's mind? That the recipe for Katie Porter, who came out for impeachment, doesn't work for the rest of those vulnerable Democrats.
Well, the thing is, a lot of them are raising a ton of money. A lot of the frontline members, as they call them, majority makers, actually have raised a ton of money. I mean, I noticed that one of the Republican recruits raised $500,000. People said they put it on the board, but it was Tom Malinowski, who you've not heard a ton about since he got elected in New Jersey, who's, he came out for impeachment, but in a kind of sorrowful way. He's been raising $500,000 a quarter. So all these guys have been raising money. The idea that they're going to lose is just the perpetual hand-wringing, I think, is what frustrates people here, right? It is just that before Democrats take any action, the sense is that they imagine how they're going to lose. They don't imagine the win. And it's very starkly compared to Trump, who picks and loses a ton of fights, but he picks them. And through the picking of them has excited his voters enough that Democrats, complete the loop, are always worried about them.
Right, right.
They're not worried about them. The only hesitation I think might be legit is it turns out that, and Republicans emphasize this because they had interest in doing so, that it can backfire. There was some backfire from the Brett Kavanaugh thing. I'm not sure if it moved Senate race votes, but it did excite Republicans more. It turns out Republicans are excited if they fight about things, if they fight for things.
Right.
And their Democrat response is, well, they're excited if we fight for things, so we're not going to...
Let's just play dead.
We're going to convince them to come on our side by not fighting as much. Yeah.
All right, so let me go through the list of people who are here, and this is getting a little meta, but it's interesting to see, particularly in the context of a presidential election, and in terms of just where who needs these people and what they're looking for. Elizabeth Warren is going to be here. She's had longtime support at Netroots.
Kristen Gillibrand is going to be here, Julian Castro, Jay Inslee. Then that's it. Mm-hmm. You have Sherrod Brown, Jeff Merkley, Barbara Lee, Pramila Jayapal, Ayanna Pressley, Ilhan Omar, Rashida Tlaib, and Deb Haaland, and Eleanor Holmes Norton. And that's it for electeds, at least, you know, federal positions. What do you make of, like, I don't know, numbers 10 through 20 on the debate stages not being here?
Well, I know that the organizers here didn't want to invite everybody on the debate stages, and they don't want to get too personal, but there are people who might have gotten okay reception here, or might have tailored a speech that did pretty well here, and they're like, we don't want to, look, it's a presidential forum, it's not a debate, we need to give everybody like 30 minutes, do we really want to make this a 7-hour thing? So there has been some surprise.
So Bill Bradley didn't, I mean, not Bill Bradley, excuse me, de Blasio did not get an invite,
he's,
maybe.
Yeah, he's not here for a reason. He isn't going to Iowa instead. But, with you know, even with that in mind, like, I think they're surprised that Booker and Harris did not adjust their schedules to be here. It's not that hard to get to Philadelphia. I mean, if you want to fly out as soon as you're done, you can. You can go anywhere. And Biden,
they were both here last year.
And they were both, that's the other thing. They were both here last year. Joe Biden was here as vice president. Bernie was here as a candidate for president. Pete Buttigieg has never been here, but would have gotten a fine reception. And most of those people decided not to come. You know, of the people, if you look at the fundraising, which is now the best, it is a pretty good yardstick, especially because grassroots fundraising has kept people in contention. Look at the fundraising of the top five candidates, one is here, which is Warren. And so from a media perspective, I think we'll see more people on Saturday. I think we'll, but it, you know, the average cattle call put on by Planned Parenthood gets 19 people, and this got 4, which is strange. Planned Parenthood's here, like the Lena Wen, they're all here. They're all like part of the coalition that wants to hear from the candidates.
What do you think that's about? I mean, is it that people perceive, the candidates perceive a danger in coming here?
Yeah, there are not many events like this where there's a risk of being booed. I've even seen people be at forums where they're not getting a great reception, but there's nothing that would be used again. There's nothing that would become a TV clip of them getting heckled. And there's frustration with how Netroots does not, I mean, there's the reason it doesn't fence everything off, but that it doesn't prevent people from kind of busting in and saying how annoyed they are.
Right. I mean, we had that last year, not last year, but in 2015 or 2015,
also,
you had Bernie.
Also in 2018, and I was trying to think of what the cause was, and I don't remember what it was. It was the very end of the conference, like really the very, like 10 minutes from breaking down the conference, and there was a protest of some kind. I think it was just generally not enough discussion about black people's issues, which is come up several times. That came up in St. Louis, that came up in New Orleans, etc. No, this was New Orleans, so it was frustration that there wasn't much. And people were confused. They're like, that was half the conference. Like,
right.
The new mayor of New Orleans is here, activists were part of it. But if you're a candidate, you don't want your guy to look bad on stage. I don't think there's any way Biden could have come here and not looked bad.
I feel like Joe Biden is the only person who could come here with a guaranteed conference-wide would be, I think, sort of impatient with him. Let's put it that way. Everybody else, I feel like there would be no unanimity, but there wouldn't be, I think, like sort of a general hostility. Maybe I'm projecting that, but that's the sense I get.
No, I think that's right. And he didn't come in 2007 when they did the first candidate forum. So he's only been here in the vehicle of a vice president who was talking about how great the Obama administration was doing. That's the only time he's been here before. Bernie has never, I wouldn't say he's never gotten over it, and it's like he's stewing, but he's never fully embraced Netroots since coming here in 2015 and having protesters interrupt him.
Right.
Which is, again, strange because he's had that happen before and he just kind of rolls with it. But here he took it personally, and he doesn't like that Marcos is moderating. They don't say that. If you ask the campaign, they say that there's a sensitive reason they can't discuss why he's not here. But, you know, he would have gotten a fine reception. I think even the people who think that he cost Hillary something wouldn't demonstrate in the hall. And if there's a bad reception, who cares?
Right.
Well, the strange thing about it, once you're president, even though all the problems lie on you, there's a whole security force designed to make sure no one ever gets to protest you, near you. Here, there's still
you're still
in the mix. You could be approached, you could be protested, and the fear people have about looking, I guess, looking weak is strange to me, because that's part of the job. And the result of the Bernie heckling in 2015 was that he upped his engagement with Black Lives Matter. The result of Harry Reid being interrupted.
To his benefit.
Yeah, the result of Harry Reid being interrupted in 2010 was...
More pressure put on marriage equality. I mean, that was sort of like the...
Yeah.
That was where we first saw the intensity of the pressure there, in fact.
It was marriage equality, I think, Don't Ask, Don't Tell at that point, too. Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah.
Well, Dave Weigel, it's always a pleasure. Yeah. I know there's a lot of people around here who are looking to protest you.
Yeah.
And they're waiting for you to get up and...
Venezuelan operatives, as usual. Yeah.
There's so many cross currents you get caught in. But I will catch up with you later.
I'll be right. Always good to be on the show.
I always appreciate it. Thank you so much.
Thank
I appreciate
you.
It.
I'm
Dave Weigel, everybody.
Of that.
he can't hear you.
Oh, I wish he could hear me.
I know. Okay. And coming. Yes, we're live right now. Okay. It's one.
All right.
Well, Jared, yeah, we had to talk to Jared. Oh, grab another chair. We got another chair.
Oh, we're live like right now?
Yes.
People can hear me talking?
Yes, they can.
All right.
Sean McKelly. There we go.
Oh. I got some problems with the Philly Bike Share program.
Hold on.
I can't get signed up.
You can't. All right, you can't get signed up onto
I can't get signed up for the Philly Bike Share program. I'm very upset.
Why is that?
I don't. It's like they want an address in Philadelphia, and I'm like, I don't live in Philadelphia.
Can't you just make one up?
I suppose. I was thinking about using the Airbnb address. But what if that is like the only time the address can be used and the Airbnb host can't get a bike share?
Well, I think that's part of the price you pay if you... part of the price you pay if you're going to the Airbnb. Oh, hold on one second. Here, let me get you. I'm sorry. Let me see your... Okay, Julian Noisecat, also from... Data for Progress. Julie?
I was just saying that this is why the Data for Progress Green New Deal also has a public option for bike shares.
Oh, is that right?
Part of the programming, yes.
Okay.
Very prominent.
Now, all right, is that serious?
Yeah.
Oh, all right.
Bike shares are part of the Green New Deal.
Okay.
Do you know how many emissions we create with our cars? You know what else is part of the Green New Deal?
I mean...
Eating fake meat to own conservatives.
Right.
That's right.
Specifically.
Every Beyond Burger or Impossible Burger you bite your teeth into, you are owning Donald Trump.
They hate that.
They do. Look, if we turn meat into a culture war, it benefits us more. Conservatives can't eat any more meat humanly, and progressives, we could eat a ton more fake meat.
All right.
Let's do it. I'm serious.
No, I know you're being serious.
Yeah.
Let me just properly introduce you.
Oh, okay.
Jesus. God.
Are you having Eric Levitz on, too?
I don't know.
You always have him on. It's like constant.
Man.
He's like, Sean, you know, Sam has me on so much more than you.
Well, I mean, he certainly follows all the protocols. Sean McKelly of Data for Progress and Julian Noisecat, Data for Progress. Just for folks who don't know, before we get into the Green New Deal stuff,
sure,
et cetera, just tell us what Data for Progress is.
Data for Progress is a think tank for the next generation of the Democratic Party.
Fair enough. And you guys do a lot of data.
Yeah, for progress.
For progress. And you're showing up in all sorts of different places these days.
Yeah.
So good for you. So what is this whole Green New Deal thing?
I'll let Julian take that.
Julian.
So the Green New Deal is a progressive climate policy that aims to take on the twin crises of climate and inequality. That's the elevator pitch. It's about fighting climate change and creating millions of green jobs in the process.
Wait, will you just go down some of the bullet points of the Green New Deal for people?
Yeah, sure. I mean, so the broad stroke is that the Green New Deal is a policy framework that aims to take on a lot. It's sort of a policy built for this maximalist era of politics that we find ourselves in. It addresses issues of economic and racial injustice. So, for example, there's a long history of pipelines, power plants, toxic waste dumps being sited in communities of color. The Green New Deal aims to take that on. We also live, obviously, in an era where unions are at one of their weakest points in American history. Last time I checked, it's like about 6% of the private sector is unionized. The Green New Deal is a climate policy that aims to empower unions and revive the labor movement as a central part of our functioning democracy. It addresses, of course, carbon pollution and greenhouse gases, but it also talks about co-pollutants. So not just the things that are heating the planet, but also the things that are giving our children asthma, polluting water, all these sorts of things. And it also sort of aims to create a more holistic vision for what climate legislation and policy might look like. It includes things like a vision for healthcare, a vision for job provisions. It understands that the way in which people experience climate change is not by the amount of carbon or parts per million in the atmosphere or even the share of renewables on the grid, but in the quality of their neighborhoods, the jobs that they're able to, apply for, the schools that their kids go to, sort of services that they're able to get in their communities. It's all those sorts of things.
So the legislation is a recognition of the totality of our life that is impacted by climate change. And it is also implicitly, or I guess explicitly, saying that to address climate change is going to take a lot more than just cutting our emissions, because the amount that we have to cut in terms of our emissions and what we're going to have to do to adapt to the problems that were already baked into the cake, as it were, are going to require like a reform across the board of our existence.
It requires direct government intervention in the economy. We have to fundamentally reconceptualize where we live, how we live, how we're building buildings, how we're building apartments, how we're building transportation. Like, all of that is fundamentally has to change if we want to address climate change. And we also have to ensure that people aren't left behind when we build this new economy. And that's why green jobs and making sure everyone has a job is such a central part of climate change, and something we haven't talked enough about, and progressives haven't talked enough about, and Democrats haven't talked enough about.
So when you go out, what does Data for Progress do in terms of bringing this about? I mean, do you go out and do polling that shows, or are you out there trying to drive support for it? I mean, what businesses of yours?
Sure. So we do a lot of polling on the Green New Deal, and we've done a lot of polling sort of explaining sort of where the Green New Deal is having most support, and we found union members are really supportive, but also the struggles the Green New Deal is having. We've found in our polling that most people hear negative things from the media about the Green New Deal. And this is not just Fox. People listening to any news source are hearing more negative messaging about the Green New Deal than they're hearing positive messaging. So we're identifying those problems, and then we're also working for solutions. We have a lot of reports out there of like what a Green New Deal can look like, and how do we have a Green New Deal that includes racial justice, and how does a Green New Deal address transportation and housing? And we also work with candidates to urge them to have more ambitious platforms on the Green New Deal. We talk with candidates like Inslee and Warren and Sanders, and push them to have the most ambitious policies that they can, and show them polling and data that having a more ambitious policy will not hurt them, but it'll actually benefit them in the elections.
When you say that it's not just Fox, like, how does is it the hosts at MSNBC or CNN that are saying, drippily saying Green New Deal with some measure of derision, Or is it simply that, like, they're repeating the fact that Nancy Pelosi says the Green New Deal is whatever, some type of Twitter festival?
What we've
whatever.
Identified as our core struggle is the Sam Cedar Majority Report. That is really where people are getting the most negative messaging. No, I think it is absolutely the fact that Schumer and Pelosi and large swaths of the Democratic establishment have decided to treat this with disdain. And so Republicans know they're supposed to hate it, but Democrats aren't being told by leadership that this is something that they should look into and see if they support.
I would say also, though, that there's a lot of studies on the lack of coverage of climate change, particularly from cable news. So Media Matters, for example, did a study a few months back of climate coverage on all of the nightly sort of cable programming and the Sunday shows. And they found that in 2018, actually, coverage of climate change, like, decreased. So I think it's both the sort of disparaging comments, you know, Pelosi going and calling the Green New Deal the Green Dream, but also sort of an inbuilt bias against climate change coverage from a lot of the major media networks.
So the way you deal with that is just get the major players who are amenable in the Democratic Party to talk about it, more? Or do you try and find marginal people who may adopt it and may, like, who are you targeting in particular? Is it just like when you say Warren Inslee and Sanders, or is it, are you?
We've talked with Harris as well. We'd like to see, and Harris actually mentioned the Green New Deal in the debates. I mean, first off, we'd like to see more candidates specifically mentioning the Green New Deal. We'd also like to see more candidates adopting a economic and inequality frame when they're talking about climate change. And that is a victory for the Green New Deal. If we're sort of starting to talk about racial justice, we're starting to talk about economic inequality when we talk about climate change. And we'd like to see this discussed in Democratic primaries. We have many members. Dan Lipinski of the House is notable, who do not support the Green New Deal. And they are facing challengers like Marie Newman, who do support the Green New Deal. And we are going to have, you know, the Green New Deal is on the ballot in these Democratic primaries. And I'm confident that members of Congress who are not supporting the Green New Deal will either get on board or they will lose their seats.
Do you have a list of primary challengers that you're looking at that you think that my audience should be looking at?
Of course. I think Newman, absolutely, front of mind. I think Richie Neal, what he's been doing in terms of slow rolling investigations into Trump's tax cuts and making deals with the shady TurboTax industry, I think he should absolutely face a primary.
He have a challenger yet?
He will soon.
That's when I would hit my breaking news story button, but I don't have it.
I think Adam Munkadeko in New York is going to run a stellar race. I think Henry Cuellar, he's facing a challenger from the Justice Democrats. I think absolutely he's one of the worst Democrats in the country. He endorsed George Bush. And I think that Elliot Engel, who represents an incredibly diverse district, he's a supporter of the Iraq War. He constantly attacks AOC and Ilhan Omar. He opposes the Iran deal. And he has just been incredibly hawkish on all aspects of foreign policy. He's slow-rolled attempts to get the U.S. out of war with Yemen. And I think that he's already facing a primary challenger also from the Justice Democrats, Jamal Bowman.
Let me ask you this. When you see what's going on with Nancy Pelosi, and I should also say, I want to make it clear, Richard Neal's in the 1st District of Massachusetts. I am not eligible even if I was to go back to Worcester. Now, Richard Neal was born in Worcester, so I don't want any rumors started. I'm all in against Schumer in 2022, or so people are hoping. But is there a number that, when you look at, let's say, what Nancy Pelosi is doing right now, and the best, I feel like the most generous perspective I can have on Nancy Pelosi right now is that that she's trying to protect, you know, these purple districts, even though Katie Porter, you know, came out for impeachment, and she's doing great, it seems. She's trying to protect these districts, and they have more of a sway over her her caucus, right? Like the problem solvers have too much leverage, whatever it is. Somehow it feels like no matter how many members of the Progressive Caucus there are,
sure,
the four who are not have more power. Is there a number that we need to get to in terms of like progressive strength in the caucus? Or is it, if you have one, can they hold the thing hostage?
I'd like to see us have the same number of progressive Democrats that are members of the squad as the Tea Party has members. And I think that, you know, we should be open to primaries against any Democrat because they shouldn't be afraid to come back to their district and tell voters what they've done. I mean, I think Jerry Nadler's a great guy. I think he's been a great Democrat for a long time. But, you know, he could today send a letter to the National Archives demanding that they release all the documentation from Brett Kavanaugh's time in the White House. And he hasn't done that. And so, you know, I think the fact that he's facing a primary challenger who's putting up $300,000 in the first quarter of the race is a good thing. I think that it's, you got to put the screws to these incumbents. You have to put pressure on them. And if they are not afraid of primaries, then they will only look to the frontline Dems. They're only going to look to those districts. And, you know, Josh Gottheimer is going to rule the day. But if we have real progressive energy coming out of these cities, and coming out of these progressive districts, I think that there's no question that we can start winning more of these fights within the caucus.
Okay, so if I hear you correctly, and this is interesting because I had not ever heard anybody articulate it this way to me. By putting pressure even on your allies, you are giving them an excuse
yep.
to get tougher. Yep. In, I mean, this is the squeaky wheel gets the oil.
Yeah.
And the problem is the squeaky wheel has just been those so-called frontline Dems, the ones who are in the purple districts. But if everybody needs some oil, essentially, because they've all got to start to squeak a little bit, if Jerry Nadler has to go back to Nancy Pelosi and say, if I don't do this, I'm going to lose.
Yeah.
And so if you know, like, why is my seat any less valuable to you than so-and-so's seat?
Yeah.
Now, that may not be quite as effective if Jerry Nadler's challenger is a guaranteed Democratic seat on some level, right? But Jerry Nadler's going to be like, I don't care if I'm as important to you, Nancy Pelosi. I got to make myself as important to my voters, so I got to start to bring them stuff. And this is going to be one of those stuff. And that's the theory there.
Absolutely. And, you know, it's not that Jerry Nadler is of no use to Nancy Pelosi. I mean, one of the undertold stories of this cycle so far is that these freshman Democrats like AOC are putting up huge numbers in fundraising because they're exciting the base, they're exciting small dollar donors to give at a time when fewer and fewer people are interested in supporting, you know, these blue dogs. People are excited about candidates like AOC, and that provides money to the party.
That's interesting. Do you think that that message is getting out?
I mean, the DCCC is still blacklisting anyone who works with a primary challenger, but, you know, at the same time, it's not working. Marie Newman raised $150,000 in the same quarter last year. This year, she put up $330,000. She's raising twice as much as she did last cycle, and that is in spite of the fact that the DCCC is trying to kneecap anyone who helps her.
Cheryl Bousas may be out of a job soon.
I do think that she will, I think that this will look very bad for her. I think that she is putting a Herculean effort to protect homophobes, bigots, and anti-choicers of all stripes. And she is not going to just lose her soul, she's going to lose her career along with it.
I love it. I love that kind of talk from Sean McElwee.
Yeah.
You know, if it wasn't for the fact that Eric Levitz delivers those lines that much better, you'd be on more.
Oh, come on.
Sorry. I mean, he's
what
just...
is he giving you that I cannot provide?
All right. Just take it easy. Take it easy. Sean McElwee, Julian, thank you so much for joining us.
You coming to my happy hour?
I will come to your happy hour.
Absolutely. Great.
All right. Well,
you got that star appeal.
Will you, where is it? Tonight? It's tonight?
Yeah, Frankie Bradley's.
Okay. All right.
7 o'clock. Sunrise is going to be
right,
there.
Text me.
Oh, no, the lovely listeners of your show can come as well. I assume no fascists are listening.
No fascists are listening, but I won't remember where it's at. So just text me with the info.
where can people get more information at Data for Progress and support the think tank? Like, do you have, like, you can get, do you have, like, having a, like, an annotated version of the the Constitution from Data for Progress? Like, something like that. Like,
you can see of all of our wonderful memes on Twitter at Data Progress. You can go to dataforprogress.org, and you can follow Julian Noisecat on J Noisecat on Twitter.
And, but is, I mean, don't you have like some type of program where people can become like, is it like the Heritage Foundation? Like you can buy
a copy
of the Constitution?
No, no. Our supporters are sort of pay pigs. We give them nothing. They just give us the money.
All right.
And that allows the operation to continue.
There you go. There you go. Well, think about the whole Constitution thing.
I'll think about it. Annotated Constitution. I like it. Will you submit some annotations?
Absolutely.
All right. Let's do it.
Just right in the margin. Like, you got to be kidding me about this shit. This is a big mistake. All right, folks. Thank you again, guys.
Absolutely.
Let me just turn down the levels here. It's getting a little bit loud around here. Folks, let me just also, since we've been a little bit meta, apologize. Wanted to have a little bit more of I've been very happy with the guests we've had. I want to have a little bit more of a diverse group of folks here. Invariably, you know, some people cancel or some people have scheduling difficulties, and it's just worked out that we've had basically just a series of guys, mostly white guys, and I want to apologize for that. We're working. Tomorrow, I think we'll be doing a little bit better on that. But the timing of the conference, we got here last night. We got to do the show first thing. And just we just have not had the opportunity to go around to the wide range of people. So it's been a lot of people who I just heard from beforehand. And to the extent that I had other people, they're just... scheduling works out in weird ways. So I want to just apologize up front for that. I should probably do the do this post roll now. What do you think? Or or we could wait until the end. We have let's do a little bit of sound.
Yeah, you might want to wait to the end on it.
Yeah, okay. David Dayan, who was with us a little bit earlier. And yes, Brendan, I would love a coffee. I think Brendan can tell that I'm... Oh, Brendan, you can't hear me. I would love a coffee. I'm fading fast. So Dayan has already filed on the private equity hospital closure in Philadelphia. Do you have the video all set? Yeah, we're getting photobombed. Can you see this in the background?
Oh, that's hilarious.
Left his best.
It's a positive photo bomb.
That's a good photo bomb.
Who's that? What's that? Yeah, come on in. I don't know who this is. Who is this?
Well, I go by many names, but some of your viewers know me by...
Other Mike.
Okay, wait, sorry. Say again?
Some of your viewers Other Mike. Know me as Fran from Philadelphia.
Fran from Philadelphia.
Oh, yes, indeed. There he is. Good to meet you, sir.
Nice to meet you.
Holy shit.
Hello.
There you go.
You being here, I just had to show up and say hello and, you know, show the Philly support.
I appreciate that.
I love
that.
You all covering Philly issues with David and, yeah.
Did you go to the protest?
I didn't go to the protest, no. I should have, though.
Well, do we have video of the protest?
Downloading now.
Oh, it's downloading now? Okay. We've uploaded the protest and... And so have you been to any, is this your first Netroots?
So I'm not actually at Netroots. See, I just work downtown, and this is open to everyone.
Oh, this
area is open to
everyone,
really?
Yeah. Oh, okay.
So, yeah, geez, where's your security detail, for God's sake?
I had
just
no
anyone
idea.
Can walk
now
in
I'm
here.
Now I'm feeling a little naked. This could get ugly, folks. I appreciate your...
Yeah, absolutely.
The left is best. There it is.
You know, I don't think I'm going to take this back to work with me, so, I'm just going to leave it here.
We're going
to
leave it right
here. Give a parting shot for the fans.
There we go.
Love you all.
All right. Thanks, Fran. It was great to see you.
That was cool.
Everybody says hi.
back in the studio.
Hey, friends.
Everybody said hi. All right. There he is, just walking out.
Yeah.
He's just, there he goes.
His job is done.
His job is done.
He
walking
did it.
Into the sunset.
That is all the right, best kind of fan interaction. They get in, they give you compliments, and then they see themselves. And you both go on with your day.
Literally walking out the door. All right. Well, look, we'll show some of the footage from the protest in a moment. In the meantime, let's take a look at this. One of the things that we had a problem with Barack Obama in, and this has come up in the context of his dismantling the Obama for America. It was indicative of it. And it is consistent with what David Dayen was talking about in terms of Bernie's campaign leveraging the assets they have, their email lists, the attention that they get for running for president, and using that for projects that are not necessarily beneficial to the, at least short term, maybe not even in the midterm, to a presidential campaign. And that is exercising power and pressure. Here is Bernie Sanders on Rachel Maddow's program last night, talking about what he's going to do to deal with Mitch McConnell. And, you know, look, this is a very obvious question in some respects, but nobody has given a satisfying answer to this. And this is when we talk about what Bernie Sanders brings to the presidency that other candidates don't or haven't articulated. I think this is really what it comes down to. Because I think, you know, you have, you know, someone like Elizabeth Warren, who I think has obviously put in a lot of work to developing plans and has a notion of what she wants to do. And these plans are good. But someone like Mitch McConnell is going to be a roadblock to this. And the question is how do you make Mitch McConnell scared? Here's Bernie Sanders on Rachel Maddow.
If he is still there,
yes.
What would you put on his plate first? What would be your first legislative priority?
I'll tell you, before I put anything on his plate, I would be in the state of Kentucky holding a rally with tens of thousands of people to say to what is in fact one of the poorest states in this country, a real struggling state in Kentucky, that we need to raise the minimum wage, a state which is really suffering for lack of health care. We're going to rally the American people in Kentucky. We're going to rally the American people in Mississippi. We're going to rally the people in South Carolina to demand that their representatives, I know this is a radical idea, actually do what the American people want. The point that I make over and over again, Rachel, is the ideas that I talk about are ideas that the American people want. They don't get it because you got a Congress indebted to wealthy campaign contributors. And by the way, whether you call it...
That's excellent.
Yeah, I mean, the point being, and, you know, this is... This dynamic came up during the fight for the Affordable Care Act, for the public option, and folks in the Democratic Party wanted Barack Obama to go to Joe Lieberman's state and to put pressure on Joe Lieberman, and he would not do it. And there has been like an allergy on the part of Democratic, largely Democratic electeds, and to a certain extent those who are just trying to run for election, to use the almost like the bully pulpit and the idea of rallying and organizing and mobilizing people to play an outside inside game is really what it comes down to. And it is, it's almost inexplicable as to why that's been the case, because at the end of the day, for the Democratic Party to be effective, it's the only way it can be. And we have had this problem since the union movement basically fell apart and or union density just dropped dramatically over the past 30, 40 years by, 25 percentage points, we've lost the outside game.
Well, that's and the Stephanie Mudge research. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, the outside game is gone. And the only way it comes back is if organizations that are forming on their own on the outside are empowered by those on the inside.
Yeah.
And it's good that Bernie's talking about that. I mean, because it really is the missing element of all of this. And just as Sean McKelvey was telling us about Jerry Nadler, you put a primary against Jerry Nadler, not because he's a bad Democrat, but because there's things on the table that he could be doing for his district that he's not doing for his district. And by primarying Jerry Nadler, what you're really doing in some ways is empowering him, because you are forcing him to use, or at the very least, you are the catalyst for him to use his power within the caucus, because he can go to Nancy Pelosi and legitimately say, hey, I need this as much as you think that person in the marginal, that frontline Democrat needs it. I need this, because if I don't get it, I'm in trouble, and I'm not going down to save that purple district congressperson's seat. And that's the dynamic that we have to get into. Here is later in that interview, Rachel Maddow has Bernie Sanders on and discussing the dynamic. We have the worst wealth inequality and income inequality that we've had in almost 100 years. And so here is Bernie describing why that dynamic has occurred.
There is a reason why in the last 30 years, the top 1% have seen an increase in their wealth of $21 trillion, while wealth has gone down for the bottom half. Why 500,000 people are sleeping out on the street. Why we are the only major country not to guarantee health care to all people, or parental leave, or sick and medical leave. There is a reason. And the reason is, and what this campaign is about, is finally saying that if you want real change, we need a political revolution. And what does that mean? It means we are going to have to take on Wall Street and the insurance companies and the drug companies and the fossil fuel industry and the military industrial complex and the prison industrial complex. In other words, we can talk about all the great things we want to do, but at the end of the day, to understand why we are where we are, where the middle class is shrinking, where 40 million people are living in poverty, we have to understand the political reality of America and the power structure of America. We are prepared to take those guys on. And that's why I say unapologetically, I am not afraid of those people. They want to condemn me. The billionaires want to condemn me that I'm an existential threat to the Democratic Party. So be it. We're going to take them on.
Yes. Yes.
I mean, that's spot on. I don't know what he's left on the table there. Nothing.
Well,
I would
not
say.
Only,
always
I, can
name
I just
our enemies.
Say really quick. Well, and of course, that's that brilliant new move of the anti-endorsement page that they have on the Sanders website now, with all of the most dangerous people in the country, like Haim Saban, who we were talking about yesterday, and Ken Langone, and all these other oligarchic predators, saying that they hate him, basically. And of course, that's the ultimate endorsement. I just want to say really briefly, I know the next guest is there, but the fact that he keeps naming the military-industrial complex is another big distinction that stands out in terms of how he's framing it. And the Obama comparison is so revealing, because you need this sort of outside agitation even for doing, Heritage Foundation healthcare policies. So you might as well go for actual serious reform.
Yep. All right. Joining me now in the conference hall, which apparently anybody can walk into, and you don't even have to be a member of the convention. And so, therefore, Brendan, you better better be on guard, because certainly our next guest would attract the attention of the wrong people in many instances. Jared Holt from the People for American Way, but I think people associate you with the Right Wing Watch.
Right, yeah.
Welcome to... Now, just tell people for who don't know what it is you do at the Right Wing Watch.
Oh, man. I assume the role of like a crazed hyper fan of right wing media and just consume all the worst stuff as aggressively as I can, and then sort of analyze it through a progressive lens and offer criticism of it and do also some reporting on extremist movements on the right.
So you basically make it possible for us to make a living on YouTube, is what it is, right?
Hey, maybe it's a side effect.
All right, but so do you have like a set, like do you just graze, or do you have like every day you've got to watch this guy, that woman, and this guy, and this network, or how does it work?
I mean, when I first started doing this work, it was very sort of regimented. But as I've, you know, I've been doing this work for like 3-4-ish years now. So I will look at the news of the day, and sort of knowing the landscape of right-wing hackery, I will sort of think and identify people that I think will have something interesting to say, or at least like at the very least funny to say.
So you're not like, I want to go check out what Glenn Beck is going to say today, but there's nobody down in the next cubicle or who's going to be like, hey, whoa, whoa, whoa.
Yeah, no.
He's mine.
No.
No. Okay. All right. So you have the opportunity to do that anytime. Okay. Well, that's good. So, all right. Let's talk about this then, since you are the expert on these lunatics. There's some type of summit going on today at the
White House?
Social
media summit,
yeah.
Man.
All right. What is that? What's happening?
So the Trump administration is inviting in a group. It's not really specified exactly how large it is, but we do know some people who have said they've been invited. It's big players in the pro-Trump social media scene. So you have everyone from Bill Mitchell, who does like Periscope broadcasts to a couple hundred thousand people each night and tells them that QAnon is like good for the Trump movement.
Right.
And then you have this guy, he goes by the handle Carpe Donctum, and he makes
Donctum.
It's like a play on Carpe Noctum, but it's like seize the donkey instead.
Oh, seize the donkey. Okay.
Yeah. So,
okay.
And if you've seen the president tweet out those like superimposed, like super cut videos, like old movies with like politician's face imposed on him and stuff, he makes those.
Super Donctum.
Donctum.
Carpe Donctum.
Donctum. Yeah.
Okay. All right.
So, what I'm saying is we've got some pretty serious people showing up to the White House today.
My understanding is that there's a lot of controversy about the people he's invited. Like, he's not invited some of the most virulent anti-Semites, and that's upsetting a part of his base.
Yeah.
And then there's other people who are embarrassed that Bill Mitchell is there.
Right, yeah, it's causing quite a bit of stir, even, like, among the pro-Trump movement. You have websites like Gab who feel like they should be in the room, but they're not. You have people like Laura Loomer, who's just losing her mind that she wasn't invited.
Is she not suing that she wasn't invited?
Hey, give it a week. I'm sure we'll see some blog posts come out. But
didn't she just sue somebody else there? Isn't she just like
Facebook.
She sued Facebook. How much did she sue Facebook?
Like to the tune of like millions of dollars.
And what is the...
It's the same stuff, man. It's like, I got kicked off, I can't make a living now, and also Facebook publicly said some mean things about me.
Okay.
I mean, it's I like to call them lawsuits, because they're just going to get laughed out of court, but...
Okay, there you go.
But yeah, so you've got this summit going on here in the White House, and it's not really going to... They're going to let in a press pool to do a spray, which for people who don't know what that is, that's like anywhere from like a minute to 3 minutes, where press comes in. They see part of the meeting and, you know, they're firing off the cameras, getting a very brief statement. But for the most part, this meeting is going to be pretty secretive, which is not reassuring, especially since during the last election we saw social media sort of gamed, you know, in favor of this stuff. But
what are these guys like? Like, presumably, like, what are they going to say? Like, look, guys, there's an account called, you know, whatever it is, you know, Joe Schmo, and retweet everything Joe Schmo says. Or are they going to go in there and they basically saying QAnon is real? Obviously, we can't let anybody know this. I mean, we don't know.
I mean, yeah, we don't know. And unless, you know, one of these folks that's been invited starts talking, A, we have to assume they're telling the truth. And B, it's just their word against what? Nothing.
Who would you put? All right, so they're going there. It's this weird crew of people and really sadly devoid of any full-on Daily Stormer people or Gab people like that, which is a real, it's upsetting to see that type of infighting.
It really breaks your heart.
It does break my heart. What, from your experience, who are the worst of the worst? And you can define worst in any way you want. Like when you, with all like the sort of the, you're like a zookeeper in a way. And you're going into the zoo and seeing who's defecated on themselves the most today.
Oh, yeah.
Right? I mean, that's sort of like the metaphor of what your job is. But you're, fortunately, you don't have to clean it up. You just take a picture of it,
right?
Essentially, right? So who is the worst? Who's the one that defecates on themselves the most in the zoo?
Oh, man. I'll split it into two, like most nefarious and then also just like the saddest.
Okay.
I think
yes.
Benny Johnson he's at TV USA now, disgraced plagiarist, and like his claim to fame now is posting like Lindsey Graham Harambe memes or something like that. But
wait, who is it? We did that guy. He's like a comedian, right?
Benny Johnson?
Benny Johnson? Which guy was that, Matt?
I mean, he's like a BuzzFeed writer.
Sometimes.
Okay.
He does All jokes, right. Yeah.
He does jokes. All
like
right.
TPUSA.
Yeah, yeah, real jokes guy.
Yeah.
but just absolutely cringe, man. It's but as far as most nefarious, there's this guy. He's existed in the right for like the better part of a decade as like this professional scam artist. He's very nefarious. He has some very close connections with some really insidious parts of the right. His name's Ali Akbar. He goes by Ali Alexander now. But he's kind of like the grease between the gears, between sort of the mainstream, we love Trump, and that's sort of as deep as it goes, and then also more nefarious figures like Chuck Johnson or like white nationalists like Nick Fuentes, and sort of lubricating that space in between.
Interesting. Those names do not come up that much on our show, I have to say, those guys.
Yeah, I mean, they're names that if you're not deep in this stuff, they're not household names by any stretch, you know?
And what is your mission? I mean, why do you have to know who these guys are? What, like, how is that helping?
Well, I mean, I think we're seeing, like, these figures, they are sort of outliers, but, you know, they're getting mainstreamed into the GOP at large. I mean, the fact that these guys, half of who, you know, nobody in this country walking down the street, if you stopped them, would know who they are,
right,
are getting White House invitations. I think that's something, you know, that should raise a red flag or at least some eyebrows. So we do what we do to try to get ahead of the curve and identify figures, identify rhetoric, identify movements that we think have potential to sort of get gripped onto if we see trends moving that way. And we try to just get archives and chronicle the activities of stuff like that. That way, when these people do go to the White House, there's some material that we can look back to,
right,
to understand who these figures are.
There's some context as to what's going on. It's just it's just reporting, and this is deep reporting. In many respects, like, I just want to say thank you for doing what you're doing and apologize that you have to do what you do. And follow, like, how do you follow a guy like Benny Johnson or the guy from TPUSA, or how do you follow Ali Akbar? Just they're writing online, or are they showing up on, like, what are the outlets that you look at? Like, is there, are there ones out there that we don't like own, or WorldNet Daily, or
so, like Gateway Pundit, WorldNet Daily, Human Events just relaunched with sort of a pro Trump spin on it. So looking at the outlets,
who's funding these things?
It's the $1 million question. Unfortunately, because these are like private entities, we don't have a clear window into that. But I'd imagine it's probably the same cast of characters we see everywhere else. Koch, Mercer, Wilkes,
right?
Those type of families.
Who funds the Blaze, like the CRTV? Like, who's the funding behind that?
I think that's Wilkes Brothers. I think they've donated a pretty large sum to them, if I remember correctly.
Interesting.
They tend to be sort of turned on to anything that has a religious bent to it, and Blaze TV definitely has had that religion, Western civilization type flavor to their content.
Interesting. Well, where can people follow your work on a regular basis?
You just follow me on Twitter at Jared L. Holt. I'm chronically online, as are all the people I track, so, you know, crack a joke here and there.
What's the burnout rate for this?
I don't know. I'm kind of amazed I haven't hit it yet. But until I do, until I smash into that wall at full force, you know, I'll keep doing what I'm doing.
What were you doing before this? Like, did you just walk into this like blind, or were you doing stuff that you were like, oh, this, I'm set up to do this?
You know, I was doing reporting in Arkansas. That's where I'm from. And I got the wise idea that I was going to freelance and cover some campaign stuff in 2014. And I covered when Mark Pryor was challenged by Tom Cotton. And that really opened my eyes pretty wide. Tom Cotton, at the time, ran a campaign that was just entirely, I'm a vet, I'm not Obama, my opponent is Obama. And he just decimated Mark Pryor in the polls.
Wow.
So that and just a bunch of like weird little stories from the campaign trail got me into it. Media market's not great in Arkansas. You know, local media just isn't doing very well in this country, and even national media is kind of hurting right now. So I moved to D.C. I was too scared to move to New York, you know, coming from Arkansas. But
yeah,
yeah, I started writing about what I knew best, which was Republican politics, conservative media.
There you go. Jared Holt, thanks so much for your time. I really appreciate
thanks.
It. We'll
it's
put your Twitter handle in the podcast description today. People can check it out.
All right.
Thanks
for
so
having
much.
Me.
We're anticipating Sarah Nelson joining us. She is the president of the Association of Flight Attendants. And I spoke to her on Ring of Fire a while back. And really looking forward to talking to her. I still believe that her work was crucial, and her union was crucial in terms of ending the government shutdown a while back. And she's running a little bit late. Do we know when, Brendan? Brendan? Do you know when she's coming? When she's coming? Oh, 2:05. All right, good. So let's just do another clip of sound. Oh, we have the footage for...
Correct, yep.
Okay. All right, so let's play some footage of... And Brendan, maybe you can tell me what we're watching here. We have footage from the protest that took place out in front of the hospital in Philadelphia. It's Hahnemann Hospital, 171-year-old hospital in Philadelphia. It is been subject to basically a private equity millionaire coming in, buying it, stripping it of its assets, selling off the land is what he wants to do. So closing the hospital, making healthcare out of reach for a lot of people who live in Philadelphia, low-income people, obviously a loss of jobs. And this is one of those situations of what stays in Philadelphia, or what happens in Philadelphia, is not going to stay in Philadelphia. This guy already has hospitals in L.A., in Chicago, other major cities. And David Dane was talking to us about it earlier, convinced that it's going to become a model. And once it goes from hospitals, it's going to go to other institutions, and it's really going to end up selling off institutions and services that service low-income areas around the country, and selling it off for gentrification and for apartments and whatnot. So let's play this clip.
Oh, we've been playing some B-roll, but I think we're going to play the Nurses Union president giving her opening speech a little bit, I think.
Oh, okay. We're going to do that. Oh, she's walking in now. Okay. So, all right, yeah, play a little bit of this speech, and we'll have Sarah Nelson on in just a sec.
Are on Medicaid, and they are losing their access to health care. This is a national health crisis, and right now it's a local health crisis. The causes are many, but the purpose of health care should be about healing. Instead, it has become about making money, not just for the wealthy hedge funds like American Academic, but for insurance companies and drug companies too. The private equity firm that bought this hospital 18 months ago wants to sell off its assets and make a lot of money doing it. We need to stop them. If they win, this will be a stain on our city that will be everlasting. Where will this end? What hospital will be next? And how many people have to die before we stop this from happening ever again?
So there she is, and she was at the at this hospital. She's coming over here right now, and that's the way it works here, folks. So, exactly. All right. So joining me now here in the Netroots Nation 2019, Sarah Nelson. She is the international president of the Association of Flight Attendants. CWA, AFL, CIO. Sarah, welcome.
Thank you very much.
So we just heard a clip of you at a speech. I guess it was right around the corner out in front of the hospital.
Oh, you did?
Yes. Oh, that wasn't her. Oh, sorry. That was a different person. It was not you. But I'm sure, given the opportunity, you would have made that speech.
I was rallying around the corner.
All right. So you and I have spoken some time ago in the wake of the government shutdown. Let's just go back over that, because I am convinced that you and your union really were the linchpin of closing or ending that government shutdown that, I guess, now 6 months ago. And so just, I mean, walk us through a little bit of that, just in what happened, because there was a real sense that when airports shut down, that's when lawmakers would pay attention. And I felt like your union gave that a little push.
Well, we definitely were very clear about what we were willing to do. But the truth of the matter is that whenever there's a government shutdown, there is a strain on safety and security in aviation. Because aviation works in partnership with our federal partners. And we had almost 2 million people out of work overnight who do jobs in the federal government, both directly and contractors. And we had almost 100,000 people who were forced to come to work as essential employees, but they didn't have the kind of backing that they normally have. These are people that normally work in offices or actually even behind secure fences, and the American public don't usually get to see who they are. And ever since the days of Ronald Reagan, we've been vilifying these people as nameless, faceless bureaucrats. And so it took time for the federal unions to get the stories out there about the real people who were being affected there. And our union was working very closely with them, but as days went on, the redundancies in safety and security that keep us safe in aviation started to stretch very, very thin. And frankly, we were very aware that we were living in a country where we were allowing a federal government to force people to come to work without pay, people who were facing a second paycheck that they were going to miss, go through incredible hardships, and we knew that we had some power at the airports because all members of Congress fly, And this is the nexus of all of our communities across the United States. It's the backbone of the American economy. And airports are where you get a lot of attention. So we were working very closely with our federal partners, but frankly, this was about the safety and security of our own members whose lives were in danger during this time because we didn't have the kinds of systems in place that it takes to run a safe and secure aviation system.
So, you know, in your retelling of that, 90% of what you were just talking about had nothing to do with your union in particular, right? I mean, you're talking about members of other unions and whatnot, and that type of solidarity, it seems to me, is sort of where the union, sort of union life has come from, but it's also feels like that's where it's got to head if there's going to be more power to unions and more power to just people, broadly speaking.
Well, look, I want to be really clear that this did directly affect our members, and we weren't going without a paycheck. We were still going to work. But what we have to understand is that what we were saying is if they can't do their job, we can't do our job. And we're connected in this country. We're connected more than we ever think about it. You know, if those planes don't take off, mail doesn't get delivered, truckers don't get to load the packages that get the goods and services to the communities that we depend on, we don't get the medicines to the hospitals for the nurses to treat the patients. This is all connected, and we have to understand that more clearly. So we have to stand up for each other and do that on purpose. But unions also need to do a better job of helping union members understand how we're connected and building this labor movement. Because when we get down to 6% in the private sector and 10% across the board, we just don't have the kind of ability to communicate with people like we did when we had 40%, and we had much more political power, we had much more say, and there was much more equality in this country. You know, we could talk about which kind of system is best, whether it's socialism or capitalism, but today we live in a capitalist society, and at least when we had 40% of workers in this country unionized, there was a check on that capitalism, and it put that check on inequality in place so that there was more shared with everyone around the nation.
As you look around with, like, you know, we had a series of teacher strikes over the past year and or two, and in areas where, you know, there weren't even technically unions, I guess, but there were associations of folks. Are there models that you're seeing out there in terms of the way unions should operate that you are trying to emulate or implementing or have been or what?
Well, I think, first of all, what we're seeing is we're seeing a lot of women step up in leadership, and this is something new. And what we have to understand is that we can win if we understand our power. And take West Virginia, for example. You know, this was mostly women-led profession, but all across the state, as every single county was determining whether or not they were going to go out on strike and grappling with that, the bus drivers told the teachers, you know what? We're not going to bring the kids to school. We've got your back. And so it takes that kind of solidarity and an understanding that what we're fighting for is for the whole community. That's what unions have to do. Unions have to make space for people who have been marginalized. In many cases, these are people who don't lead with ego, who have creativity, and who are going to fight hard because we've had to fight hard our whole lives just to get to where we are. So I think that, you know, what we're modeling right now is that union membership is really about the American worker, and it's not necessarily who you might think comes from central casting. This is anyone who works for a living in this country can join a union, can have power by joining a union, and it means that if you're going to join a union, then you care about your community. And so that's what we really have to be modeling here. That's what happened in West Virginia, and the rest of the state was with them because they understood that their kids were suffering. And their communities were suffering because businesses don't want to bring their business to a community that doesn't have good schools. It's all connected. And the more that we allow the bondholders and the special interests to take more from the American public and create this greater inequality, the more that we're going to see that the rubber band is breaking all across the country. And you're going to see people rising up in response to that. But we're only going to be able to sustain that if we also at the same time understand how we can sustain it. And that is by building the labor movement.
So, I mean, are you articulating sort of what they call the social justice unionism? Or, I mean, is that...
I think that as long as we think that our issues are unique and economic issues are not also social justice issues, then we're going to lose. And we have to understand that the way that we win is by bringing people together. So racism, sexism, these are issues that unions have to take on because these have been the tactics of the boss. No one is born racist. No one's born sexist. These are tools that are used to divide and keep a few people in power when the rest of us really have all the power that we need to have just by sticking our hands in our pockets and telling the boss no.
So what are you guys doing? Like, what do you do as an institution now to sort of pursue that when it's not... You're not in a position to sort of like, you're not striking, but what are you doing in the meantime? What does a union do in that beyond the servicing of what the members need at any given point?
Well, I think that there has to be a constant organizing in the workplace because the good news is that there's no shortage of struggles for labor. There's no shortage of issues for the American worker. And so if you are constantly organizing and understanding what members care about, and you are identifying those issues and being very focused about what the order is that you're going to take them on, because you can't take on everything all at once. But if you're constantly assessing where members are, what they care about, organizing them around that issue and working for a result, unions can actually get results very, very quickly. And that will encourage more people to get involved. You know, a lot of people are talking about it because these teachers have gotten results within what it appears to be a couple days. What you don't see is all the organizing that happened before that to determine what the issues were, what kind of structure tests they were doing to determine how many people would support that, and how they could sustain a strike. So there's a lot of work that goes on in the background, but what we have to understand is when you do that work, you don't have to wait for the next election to get results, and most Americans would tell you you're not even going to get results at another election. You can take on these issues right in the workplace, get results quickly, and get people energized around the fact that they actually have power right where they live and right where they work to make change.
Do private unions have a greater national agenda that you're looking for? You know, is we're entering into a presidential year. Are you guys how engaged in that? Is your union?
Well, our union is just actually completed a census of our union to determine who our members are today, what they care about, and how we can be more intentional about reaching out to make sure that we have leadership that represents every constituency of our union. We're getting ready to report out on the results of that census and take action on it. And the other thing that we did
in
the process...
So do you guys endorse? Will you endorse a candidate in the primary?
We are going to continue to talk with the candidates, and if the candidates meet a certain set of metrics and get into our workplace and we get a response from our members on who they support and it's very clear, then we will. But it will be based on the action and the input from our members and not a decision that we make with a board at a high level.
I see. So if a certain amount of your members hit a threshold, that's when you guys endorse.
That's right. And we're going to actively engage with the candidates. But, you know, they're coming to us. They're coming to us and asking us for an endorsement. We are not seeking that out. And so if they want to work with us and they want to communicate with our members what they're ready to do to address the issues that matter to our members, we're going to communicate that back. And if we get to a majority, then we will endorse.
Sarah Nelson, International President, Association of Flight Attendants. Thanks so much for your time today.
Thank you. Really appreciate it.
All right, folks. All right, let's... you know what we should do is we should probably take this time right now to, of course, listen to Seb Gorka, who apparently has... Seb Gorka apparently still has a radio show, and he is still... trying to deal with hostile callers. Oh, look. It is par for the course. It's just, it's, it should go without saying that when you do a radio show, when you do any type of public presentation, you're going to get, you know, sometimes hostile calls. You got to learn to be able to handle it. Not have yourself completely break down.
If you handle them right, you can turn them into YouTube content and make more money on top of them.
It's true. There's no reason to be to get so upset about these things, but Seb Gorka just can't seem to not have a meltdown. Let's play this thing.
3346752. Best part of the show is you, Jason.
Oh, he's so excited.
Idaho, line three.
Hey, Mr. Gorka, thank you for taking my call. I'm excited. Love your voice on the radio. It's, radio was meant for you, sir.
That's very kind. You've got some pipes yourself.
Aww. Oh, that's nice. Butter. Nothing compared to you, though. I feel like if you're having a debate with some liberal, you could just start talking and they'd start shaking in their boots.
Yeah, they usually end up as little puddles on the floor. But thanks for calling, Jason. Share, you've got 60 seconds. Share your wisdom.
Well, my favorite magazine just did a little feature on you saying you were the top journalist of this year, and I was really excited, and I wasn't sure if you were aware of that yet.
No. What is this that you are talking of?
It's called Dipshit Magazine.
Oh, you're one of those. Ah. This is the definition of a coward. I love it how they lie. I'll talk to Jason offline. This is Sebastian Gorka. Oh, he's dropped off. What does that mean? What does that mean, Jason, that you dropped off?
It means
mean
he's
you're a
done.
Girl? I think it does mean you're a little girl. You're a sad little coward. But you know what? It's a great metric when they actually spend their time listening to this show. What does it mean? It means we're I love it so much.
Love it.
It means they're done owning you.
I love it. I love it so much. You know, I'll tell you something. I don't know if the caller was, in fact, a little girl, but I can tell you that if my daughter was to do something like that, the pride I would feel would be inexplicable.
Also, the mimicry skills would be incredible. A little girl could completely modulate her voice like that. I mean,
she
that
sounded
would be amazing.
Like, she sounded like a I don't know, a 30-year-old man.
Yeah. I would love in the sketch version, though, like, nothing bothers you. In fact, of course, if some idiot calls up and says, like, oh, I'd like to debate the idea of having water treatment facilities, you're like, great, let's take 45 minutes and talk about this nonsense. But if somebody called up and they were just like, Sam, you were rated best progressive talker by a magazine I read. Like, oh, really, Brendan? Did you know about this? Yeah, Dipshit Magazine. You go, oh, fuck you! and that's like when you finally lose your mind. You're a scared little girl. Don't you come to the Gowanus and say that to my face?
You coward.
You coward.
You coward.
I can say it was not, in fact, a girl that was a pranking Gorka. It was actually Chris James, a Canadian comedian and host of Not Even a Show, which is currently my favorite YouTube show.
He just butters them up.
He
keeps nailing Gorka over and over again.
I just love it.
And Gorka wants the opportunity to keep him on the line so he can threaten him. You know that's what it is, right?
Oh, totally. Yes.
And, frankly, keeping him on the line and hearing what Gorka would say would also be worthwhile, it seems to me.
Yeah, well, last time, if you remember, he did the thing where he talked about how he had this liberal sister that thought Gorka looked like he had bad breath and like was a bootlicker.
Do you remember you know what would be really funny, actually? I can't go into the whole... Do you remember when your Kickstarter sucks, guys? They did this whole elaborate prank where they had a fake Facebook post where they said that their cousin owned a restaurant and their cousin hated Trump voters. So what they were doing is that when Trump voters came in and ordered a meal, they were putting the chicken or whatever, like the meat on the floor before they cooked it. It was like the most nonsensical, like but of course
it was written as if like, so hey, I got an uncle that works for this restaurant,
right?
And he was telling me about this thing they do to Trump voters where they put the chicken on the floor before they serve
right,
it to
and
him.
Of course, like Trump voters who read this, not considering like, how would the restaurant know? You mean you put it on the floor? Like, what are you talking about? But instead they called and they got these enraged phone calls. And I remember the best one was this guy's like, I'm going to report you to like, you know, to some health authority. And the guy's like, ooh, yeah, that would be super unhelpful if you did that. Because, I mean, we're trying to run a restaurant here.
Actually,
it would be funny if they did that with Gorka.
Chris James has some relation to the Yorkshire Sucks guys. They are Twitch together, I think, on the Go Off Kings. I might be getting that wrong, but I think there's some relation there.
Well, good stuff. Let's do just a couple more clips of sound, and then we will begin to wrap things up. This is pretty important. There's talk that the Fed is going to drop rates again soon. And part of this is, I mean, there's varying concerns going both ways. One of the fears is that in the event that there is another financial crash, that there won't be room for the federal interest rate to drop more, which eases things by providing more money into the economy. Right now, I think the Fed rate is like 2.25%. And there's pressure for the Fed chair to drop it, not the least of which because Donald Trump needs a little boost to the economy and going into an election. Here is a clip of AOC talking to Chairman Powell about the relationship between Fed rates and employment. As you know, the Fed has a dual mandate. And one of them is to actually promote employment in the country, in addition to maintaining a lid on inflation. That's a dual mandate that they have. Far too often, they have erred on the side of keeping inflation low because that is very beneficial for people who have loaned out money, and inflation would cut away at the value of the interest that they're making on those loans. And so the inflation hawks very much about protecting the interests of banks and loaners and whatnot. I mean, inflation across the board is not necessarily good for workers, but presumably as inflation goes, so do wages. So really, the big losers in inflation tend to be people who own a lot of debt, essentially, and or have offered a lot of credit. Here is AOC questioning Powell on the presumptions that the Fed have been operating under for, I don't know, decades, like the mainstream economic thought.
And I've been seeing lately that economists are increasingly worried that the idea of a Phillips curve that links unemployment and inflation is no longer describing what is happening in today's economy. Have you been considering on that? What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, very much so. We spend a great deal of time on that. The connection between slack in the economy or the level of unemployment and inflation was very strong if you go back 50 years, and it's gotten weaker and weaker and weaker to the point where it's a faint heartbeat that you can hear now. It's still there. You can see it at state-level data and things like that. But I think we really have learned, though, that the economy can sustain much lower unemployment than we thought without troubling levels of inflation.
Mm-hmm.
And I think I would look at today's level of unemployment as well within the range of potential estimates, of plausible estimates of what the natural rate of unemployment is.
All right. Matt, you got to raise audio levels for me.
Oh,
I can't. I couldn't really hear that too much. But the gist of it essentially is that this presumption that we've been living under for decades now is no longer operative. And this idea that inflation may run amok unless rates are raised, thereby sort of slowing down the economy and hurting the employment, has been inoperative. And frankly, the economics profession has yet to figure out, I think, this dynamic. And it's one more reason to be skeptical about economics as some type of science, as opposed to a almost a reverse engineering of some political decisions. I mean, surely there's some economic principles that are real, but too often we're simply told this is the way economics works. In fact, what we're hearing is this is a political decision we're making, and it generally benefits people with money.
Right.
So it's nice to see AOC up there. Of course, she has no idea what she's talking about, right?
None. I mean,
how's that
None.
Program on the right going where they're making her out to be like a elementary school kid?
Anybody could come up with that question. I'm actually not only the point about the stupidity of that meme on the right, but I'm reminded of one of the earlier points that the staffers for AOC and I think Rashida Tlaib were making, that not that they just have a lot more time to prepare because they're not fundraising constantly.
Right.
Yeah, that's cheating.
Right.
All right, let's play this last clip, and then we're going to wrap things up. We're not going to get any calls or IMs today. We'll try and get to some time tomorrow.
I'll tell you guys about my time at Commie Camp tomorrow.
Definitely not
today.
Oh,
yeah, we may have to do that. We may have to do that. We'll have to pump that to tomorrow. But
we're going to do that for an hour tomorrow.
Ben Shapiro apparently has to weigh in on what's going on. As you know, the women's soccer team has won their fifth. Is it the fifth?
I thought it was the fourth, right?
Or no. The fourth. Their fourth World Cup. And the star, Rapinoe. I don't even know her first name.
It's Megan.
Megan Rapinoe. In fact, our own former booker, Jess Mabley, got like a picture with for her kid. Nevertheless, Megan Rapinoe has been outspoken in their critique of Donald Trump and outspoken in their desire to be outspoken. And apparently this is really, really bothering those on the right. Here is Ben Shapiro, famed soccer critic.
You're saying capitalism can actually increase your pay. That's never going to be a thing that anyone on the left asks. Instead, we all have to pretend that this is all normal and that it's not divisive at all and that truly she's a hero to everyone. Absolute, absolute silliness. Absolute silliness and bad for the country, by the way. When even the stuff that we take a break with, you know, sporting, is turned into this, it's pretty obnoxious. And we're not talking about 1968 in the middle of the civil rights movement with U.S. sprinters on the U.S. national team at the Olympics raising the black power fist because American politics are polarized around race in 68. We're not talking about that. We're talking about gay marriage is legal across the United States by Supreme Court diktat.
Hold on, pause it for one second.
I'm sure he would have been on the right side of 68.
Exactly.
Yeah.
If this was 1968 and any of those athletes were raising the black power sign at the Olympics, he would have the exact same thing.
This is the
oldest game in the world they play. Look, I'm telling you, whoever is the next Democratic president, I don't care if it's Joe Biden, I don't care if it's Amy Klobuchar, I don't care if it's
I
don't care if it's AOC or Bernie Sanders or Elizabeth Warren or you know, people
Jay
who haven't
Inslee,
run. Jay Inslee, it doesn't matter. They're all going to say that person is a full-on commie socialist. And why can't they be reasonable like Obama? That's the way they go back. I'm going to pretend like I wouldn't have or didn't critique Democratic figures in the past in the exact same way, and now you look at them, they're so reasonable back then, and now they're just crazy. But let's continue. He is upset that, of course, the women's soccer team is insisting upon getting paid a fair wage for the same job that they do. And it's just such a shame for him that he can't even watch soccer anymore without it being politicized. Like, these people want their rights. They want to be able to get paid what other people get paid. Why can't you just play? Dance, monkey, dance, is what he's begging.
We're not talking about that. We're talking about gay marriage is legal across the United States by Supreme Court diktat. We are talking about Megan Rapinoe is getting million-dollar contracts specifically because of her sexuality and because she is a very, very good soccer player. But let's not make any mistake. If she were a very good soccer player and she were not a very outspoken lesbian, she would be getting fewer contracts because she's seen as a political figure. She's sort of Colin Kaepernick, but with actual talent at her sport.
Ooh.
So it's all of this is obnoxious, but we're supposed to pretend that actually she's quite charming and wonderful, that it is not obnoxious to live in the most... to live in the best time for women, in the best time for lesbians, in the best time for women's soccer in the history of the world, and in the best country in the history of the world for any of those things, we're supposed to pretend that actually she's a victim and America's a terrible place so that she can make more money, presumably. Pretty gross.
Pretty gross. I don't know that America's ever been the best for soccer.
I don't know that Colin Kaepernick is an outspoken lesbian.
Yeah, no, Colin Kaepernick is an outspoken lesbian. That was actually what...
So his argument is that if she was... an outspoken straight woman, she wouldn't get as many contracts?
I get probably actually get... if she was running around saying straight power, no marriage equality, yeah, it actually probably would
that's
be a problem.
Thing.
But that's just because we're like we have culturally evolved. Like,
right.
Yes. Ben, that would actually be a problem.
Ben says something early on where he's like, she doesn't want to be a role model to she's being a role model to everybody. It's like, no, she's not. She's not trying to be a role model to like nasty little bigots like yourself, Ben. She's trying to be a role model for like people who want to see this country progress.
Yeah, I don't even know. I mean, she's. I also just think like I find it so. There's something so torpish about both people who reject sports because they have like some attitude about athletics in general, and then people like Shapiro who are like, this is where we get our entertainment. This is where we tune out. Like this very like weird like politics and sports have always been connected. What are you talking about? It's one of the biggest cultural forces in our lives. It overlaps with politics everywhere. There's soccer violence across Europe. There's clubs that are associated with different political teams. It affects, I mean, even the fist thing that he mentioned hurt those guys' careers for decades, including the Australian guy up there on stage who was in solidarity with them. He had a totally destroyed career too. I mean, what is he talking about?
Yeah, he might want sports to be a realm that's insulated from politics, but guess what? Facts don't care about your feelings, Ben.
That's right. And
right.
On top of it, he also doesn't care about facts being about politics and sports commingling because he just doesn't want politics that disagree with his politics
right.
commingling. Right. Like,
right.
You know, like
he
where
would
was
love
he?
It.
I mean, like what was John Rocker? Like, I mean, like,
or
imagine
Tim Tebow.
Like, yeah,
Tebow.
Like I'm sure he was not out there criticizing Tim Tebow. Oh, my God. And how often, like, why do we have to have religion commingle with our sports? Like,
well, you know, he'd say like being pro-life isn't a political statement,
right?
Right.
Yeah.
But here's the thing. But why should religion? But here's the fact is that politics is infused with just about every single thing we do in society, and everything we do, every choice that we make, every choice that is made for us, every context in which we make those choices, in some way is a function of politics. And the reason why a guy like Shapiro wants this to be denied and wants it to be sort of like verboten to bring up these issues is because they have gotten away with subjugating various people in the context of this stuff by just the frontline defense has been like, don't make this political. Don't make this about your... I mean, this is the extension of the IDW, too, in some ways, right? Because this is what they're saying. It's like, look, we resent the fact that you now are asserting your right to be offended by stuff that we've gotten away with our whole lives and careers. And we resent the fact that we now have to address this. Like, you're taking us out of our comfort zone, and we have a right to be comfortable because we've always been comfortable. And the fact that you have actually been always uncomfortable and are now finally in a position in terms of society to be able to speak up and say, hey, this is making me uncomfortable. Like, I don't like this. That is what they resent. And that is the entire, like, sort of like political project of the IDW. And it is, it's why they're just squawking so much. I mean, that's just the bottom line. I mean, you know, that's it.
Yeah, but a lot going on there. But anyways.
Great ideas.
Great ideas.
Great ideas. All right, well, folks, that's all the time that we have for this program. I will be back here in this space tomorrow, literally in this space, in the Netroots Nation Hall in Philadelphia. We'll have more great folks to talk to. And I won't forget the post-roll. In fact, I have it right here. Before I go, this episode was brought to you by Blinkist. The Blinkist app takes the key takeaways from thousands of best-selling nonfiction books and condenses them down into just 15 minutes for you to read or listen to. 10 million people are using Blinkist right now. It has a massive and growing library from self-help to business to health and history books. Folks, you don't have time to read. I'm sorry. It's not my fault. It's just the reality. Well, right now, you can get 25% off your first year at Blinkist.com/majority. That's Blinkist.com/majority. Check it out. All right, folks. Also, a reminder, your support makes this show possible. You can become a member at JoinTheMajorityReport.com. I guess it's a freebie. Freebie.
Freebie Thursday.
All right. See you tomorrow.
It might take all the strength I got to get to where I want, but I know somehow I'm gonna get there. I wasn't looking when I just got caught between the truth and the light bulb. But finding out won't make me feel any better. Yeah, I know the clock is ticking, but the meds are gonna kick in, and my pilot light's shining bright. I guess I'm where the choice was made, for the option where you don't get paid, for the road that bends before it finally breaks you. I guess somehow I lost my drive between the 101 and the 5. Do you know how far the detour takes you? Yeah, I know the clock is ticking, but the meds are gonna kick in, and my pilot light shining bright. Shifted in and out of gear, waiting for my moment to happen. I don't know how much longer I can stay in, or how much more I got to pay to play in. I know somehow the lights got graded somewhere before the credits faded. But my pilot light shining. Pilot light shining bright.